Sorry about that. Yeah, we called a resources committee to order. In attendance, we have Representative Crawford, Elkins, Samuels, Olson, Kapsner, and in the audience, we have Representative Rokeberg. We'd like to start with House Bill 501. This bill, with the exact same bill, passed out of the committee, I believe, within the last couple of weeks anyway. And we're going to bring it forward as a resources bill again. Open up public testimony online. We have Rod Arno from the Alaska Outdoor Council. Are you with us, Rod?
Yes, Chairman.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. Yeah, I'm Rod Arno, the Alaska Outdoor Council. And the Outdoor Council's Board of Directors has voted to oppose this piece of legislation. And we still feel back to the beginning that we're concerned of lowering the bar on the amount of meat harvested at any time, and believe that the provisions already in statute, if we had the enforcement, would be the correct way to go. Thank you for your time, sir.
See, Mr. Arnie, this is Representative Samuels. Your concern is that this legislation lowers the bar?
Yeah, through the co-chair, yes. That's exactly what it does, because under one waste of big game animals now, it's the entire weight of the meat. There is no ability for the Board of Game to come up with the lowering of the amount of salvageable meat that would be necessary.
Okay, thank you. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify on House Bill 501? And with that, we're going to set House Bill 501 aside for the time being. Next up is House Bill 378. And Representative Kapsner will address your. At the end of this meeting, what we will probably be doing is recess to the call of the chair and try to meet again tomorrow at 1. To try to, I just don't know if we're going to get through the oil bill that we have today. With that, next up is House Bill 378. Go ahead.
For the record, I'm Casey Schroeder-Hotch, staff to Rep. Thomas. The Alaska Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve was created in 1982, and it's located along the Haines Highway. And it was created to protect the world's largest concentration of bald eagles, which the Chilkat Valley is known for. Not only is it home to many eagles, it's also home to several species of salmon and other wildlife. In order to protect the sanctity and utility of the Eagle Preserve, a 12-seat advisory council was created, and one of those seats was designated to the mayor of the city of Haines. However, since then, the borough and the city have consolidated, so there is no longer a mayor of the city of Haines, so that seat is open. So what CS for House Bill 378 does is it designates that seat to a member of the borough assembly that has been selected by the borough assembly. And I'm referring to the CS version S. So with that, I would attempt to answer any questions that you might have.
Are there any questions? You're working off of version L?
No, S came in late this morning.
L.
Take a brief at ease.
Which one? Not Y, not L.
Thank you. Are there any questions? You're getting a motion to adopt the S version of the CS?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt version 24-LS1486/S, CS for House Bill 378.
Is there any objection to that? Hearing none, we've got the CS backslash S version in front of us. Are there any other questions? Is there anybody else online? We have a Mr. Lewansky from the Division of State Parks. Jerry, are you with us? Lesinski?
Yeah. I'm sorry, I guess I was muted there, but I was available for questions on House Bill 378, and I was disconnected there for a minute. I didn't know what the consequence of or where that bill went. So if there were any questions on that one, I was available.
Yeah, that's what we're asking right now. Are you supportive of the bill?
I'm supportive of the bill. I consider it almost just to be housekeeping. I support it. I think it's a good decision to keep management of that board intact and whole.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions for the division? No. Okay. Is there any discussion, or what is the will of the committee for House Bill 378?
Chairman, I'll move House Bill 378, version S, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Okay. Zero fiscal note?
Zero fiscal note. Is there any objection to that? No, seeing none, House Bill 378 is moved from committee.
Thank you.
Nick,
go away.
Both need a few minutes to come down.
Okay, next up we're going to take House Bill 498. Representative Roeckberg. Just to clarify that we are dealing with the I version, Representative Roeckberg?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Can you get a motion to adopt the I version of the CS, please?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt version 24-LS1817/ICS for House Bill number 498.
Okay. Is there any objection to that? Hearing none, we have the I version of 498 before us. Representative Roeckberg.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. I'm Representative Norman Roeckberg from District 27. It represents South Spinard, Sand Lake, and Fire Island in Anchorage, Alaska. And, Mr. Chairman, before the committee, we have a standalone bill designed to provide additional tax credits to the Petroleum Ministry for the development of viscous or heavy oil on the North Slope, as well as another type of formation called carbonate that provides a 15% tax credit on top of the 20% contemplated under House Bill 488 that was moved out of this committee. Seems like a long time ago. Additionally, Mr. Chairman, it provides in the second section of the bill a 25% credit for development of alternate energy projects, that credit being only applicable against the production or severance taxes in the state of Alaska. Mr. Chairman, I've been working on this particular issue for over a decade because, Mr. Chairman, we have in excess of 20 billion barrels of heavy oil in the North Slope of Alaska. And as this committee has heard, the potentiality for improving or maintaining any kind of level of production and lift on the North Slope is dependent in large part on the ability of the industry to develop and commercialize that heavy oil resource that we have. So that's the intention of this particular bill, is to provide additional incentive for the heavy oil that we have there and incent its development. In part, Mr. Chairman, one of the motivations for introducing this bill at this time also is recognition of the importance of heavy oil, but also to provide an additional offset to any tax rate that may be contemplated by the legislature in adjusting the production tax under the PPT. But, Mr. Chairman, we do have several expert witnesses that are here to explain to the committee in further detail the nature of the heavy oil resource we have, how we need to develop that, and why. In addition, we have in the audience Ms. Robin Wilson, the Department of Revenue, has been working hard on trying to make this a workable bill that is consistent with the PPT bills, that being one of the goals. And also, I suspect we'll hear from Mr. Van Dyke, I believe, maybe online.
Yes.
And there are some policy issues I believe this committee should undertake and look at. I direct the committee's attention to page 3, starting on line 14, this subsection F is the essence of the bill as to how the actual credit is to be applied. And as previously discussed in the Oil and Gas Committee, and when you were in attendance, Mr. Chairman, one of the issues had to do with page 3, line 19, and sub 1B, what is meant by incurred for activities in the state for research or development of challenged or non-conventional oil. Basically, what we're calling here is heavy oil is challenged oil. So one of the policy calls here is, number one, should we allow research as a qualified capital expenditure? And in addition to that, the development of the challenged oil or heavy oil. And secondly, whether this particular research can be done only in state. So that's an issue I'd like to have the committee address, is if the research that goes on, it could go on, say, in Houston or another province, even in Alberta, if you will. But if it is directly related to lifting heavy oil on the North Slope, the question is, should that be allowed as a qualified capital expenditure, even though it was not in the state? So that's one issue. The next I'd like to bring your attention is on page 3, subsection small g on line 25, is the entire definition of what challenged oil is. The baseline used in the bill is a 25 API gravity for those areas north of 68 degrees, 15 minutes north latitude, Yale Lumiat line, and with true vertical depth is measured from sea level of 5,500 feet or less. So this is where the viscous oil is. It's a shallower depth, it's thicker, more difficult to produce. We've selected the API gravity standard, and this is, there's some debate about whether that's the appropriate measure or benchmark. Additionally, I asked the drafter to go below that in sub B, C, D, and E, going all the way down to F. We've used that standard except in sub D, where if you're not within these particular areas, it can be anywhere in a state and it has an API gravity of 18 or less. And one of the issues that I think is the public, as a policy call that needs to be made by the committee, is whether we maintain that 25 API gravity standard or just call out the various formations. Looking on page 4, starting in lines 3.
And if I could interrupt you for just 1 second, just for the committee's edification here. Mr. Spencer from ConocoPhillips is here, I believe, an engineer. And Mr. Pascavan from BP, who testified, and both these gentlemen testified in the Oil and Gas Committee, that can speak more about what the gravity of the oil means, the different types of recovery techniques that are listed on page 4 also. So we'll get some expert testimony on how it works, how expensive certain procedures are. So I'm sorry, Representative Brooks.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that. We will be educating the committee so they can have a proper discussion. Mr. Chairman, I would point out that on page 5, it indicates the Ugnew Formation or West Sac and Trader Bluff formations, or a formation that's stratigraphically equivalent or to shallower than a formation like the Ugnew West Sac or Trader Bluff. Then it goes on in C to call out the participating areas. There has been some discussion between the producers and DOG, the Division of Oil and Gas, whether naming the formations in and of itself and deleting the gravity benchmark would be the appropriate way to go. So that's another policy call that needs to be made. My own preference is maintaining some kind of a verifiable standard. I'd like to even see a centipoidal measurement, but I've been talked out of that. And, Mr. Chairman, on page 4, line 15, the sub-E, where it talks about the EOR, or enhanced recovery methodologies, it may be because this was in the original bill when we had other kinds of challenged oil, not just heavy oil, that this may be redundant. It may be probably be able to be deleted from the bills because in my opinion, anything that's related to the development of heavy oil should be a qualified capital expense. So that being also any EOR. What we originally did here was list things which were new cutting-edge technology, and the original draft of the bill had them even apply these new EOR techniques to light oil as well. So because all this is now for heavy oil or carbonate, it may be able to be deleted. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll allow more expert witnesses testify. We have, I haven't provided for the committee, but we will be hearing from Ms. Wilson, who's kind enough to provide me with some comments and some additional corrections and recommendations that we should be undertaking with. We can all rely on her, and if there's any questions, Mr. Chairman, then I'll step aside and allow the witnesses.
Okay. Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Roper, there's a real interesting section in here about renewable resources. I wondered if you'd go ahead and explain what your reasoning and thinking, and I'll include that in here. What were you planning when you included that in the bill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to put a smile on Representative Crawford's and Berkowitz's face. That's one of my objectives. Through the chair, Representative Crawford, thank you for the question. It's I believe it's important. We've been talking about various alternate energy forms, formats, project technologies, particularly in rural Alaska, where there's some proven technologies, but there's been a dearth of funding and the inability to find funding sources to move out in this area. So I basically made a judgment call that this might be an area that we could get some potential funding from the private sector to really jumpstart some of these projects, because that's been the biggest problem. You know, if you want to take the next step, we do have some wind-generated power in the state, but if you want to take the next step, it's going to take a substantial capital requirement. And so there, I think, is a potential source of funding which would go only against the production tax. It's limited to those producers. And it seems as if the producers are painting themselves as more gentler and kinder and greener than in the past. And so here's a way, I believe, that they could put up and shut up and move forward on it. So I propose this in the bill for the consideration of the legislature.
So to follow up on Representative Crawford's question, the only people that would be eligible for this would be an oil-producing company. So if Concor, BP, or Exxon, or Anadarko, one of the companies, wanted to invest in wind power at Kotzebue or in Fire Island or wherever, they could get a credit.
I'd rather think of Nikiksit and other places, in Kaktovik, yeah.
Against their separate tax.
Right. That's correct, Mr. Chairman. It is limited for that purpose, because only a firm that had a production tax at which they could apply the credit would benefit from it. It's not meant as a law of general application through all corporations. Okay.
Thank you. Any more questions for Representative Roper? I think next we'll let me go to the industry folks, the engineers. I'll have some questions on maybe Mr. Spencer. Or I don't know if... both of you are coming up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome to join us up here, Representative Roper.
Yeah, I called.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Brian Wenzel.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm the Vice President of Finance and Administration for ConocoPhillips. I have with me here today Jeff Spencer, who is one of our experts in heavy oil for ConocoPhillips, working on Clark. So we'd like to obviously allow Jeff to spend some time providing some education on heavy oil and how we look at heavy oil and that resource. But as an introduction, I just wanted to mention that we do appreciate both the efforts of the sponsor, the bill sponsor, but also the efforts of this committee and those before it to look at this very important topic. We think it is, as we've testified before, a very key resource that will be very helpful in the future in terms of mitigating production decline on the North Slope. And for that reason, we are grateful that the committee is taking the time at this late date in session to look at this, because we think it is very important. At the same time, I'd also say, as you won't be surprised, that this is but a piece that only works with the right foundation in terms of the right overall oil fiscal structure, which is currently being debated through the rest of the through the rest of the bodies. So, with that intro, let me let Jeff go ahead and start.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as Brian mentioned, my name is Jeffrey Spencer. I'm the Greater Park Area Heavy Oil Development Supervisor for ConocoPhillips. I'm also a proud graduate of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Petroleum Engineering Department. And as a way of a little background, after working various oil and gas fields in Wyoming, West Texas, and New Mexico, I returned to Alaska 9 years ago, and since then have worked a variety of positions in the Prudhoe Field, Tarn, Kuparuk, the Alpine Satellites, and then now, before taking my current position, where I have responsibility for ongoing and future developments of the West Sac Reservoir and hopefully someday the Ugnew Reservoir. So if you go to the first slide, it's just an overview map, and as you're probably aware, the North Slope has very large heavy oil resources in place that's sitting above the currently producing light oil reservoirs, Kuparuk and Prudhoe. The viscous oil resource is predominantly located in five fields. West Sac at Kuparuk and the equivalent Schrader Bluff formation at Milne Point, Orion, and Polaris, and also the shallower Ugnew sands that predominantly overlie the Kuparuk River unit and the Milne Point unit. Turn to the next slide. In total, we estimate there's approximately 23 to 24 billion barrels of heavy oil in place on the North Slope, and it's about evenly split between the West Sac Schrader Bluff formation and the Ugnew formation. Within the ConocoPhillips-operated Kuparuk River unit itself, there are approximately 16 billion barrels of oil in place, and again, it's about evenly split between the West Sac Reservoir and the Ugnew Reservoir.
So, I have a question. You're on the slide right here.
Sure. Okay.
One of the ideas is, if you look at three different ways that the bill addresses the way to determine it. One is just by geography, you know, at a certain depth in West Sac or Milne or Orion or wherever, that whole area is a credit because it's all heavy oil. Now, is that necessarily true? I mean, if you drill deeper, do you get lighter oil? Or as I said in the previous committee, try to see it from our point of view. Right. Is if we give you a credit for drilling to 5,000 feet, do you use the same drill rig and the same cost and everything to go down further, but now we're giving you a higher credit on something you've already got there? Or is it pretty much everything in West Sac is heavy oil?
Mr. Chairman, West Sac, the oil contained within the West Sac Reservoir, within the Kuparuk River unit, is heavy. And we'll get into a little bit more of the definition of what that is in further slides.
Okay, well, maybe as you continue, the difference between the weight of the oil, how do you measure the weight of the oil as it comes out of the ground vis-a-vis a tax program versus the geography versus the method that you use to recover the oil? Do you use the same methods, three different ways to kind of do the same thing? Maybe you can, as you go through the presentation, try to differentiate how the different ways that we should look at these and if the company had a preference. And then we'll ask the division the same thing, the tax people the same exact questions.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind.
Thank you.
Going to the next slide, please. These viscous oil resources are located below the permafrost and shallow reservoirs from approximately 3,000 to 4,500 feet. And the shallow depths and thick permafrost results in low reservoir temperatures, typically in the range of 40 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. These relatively low reservoir temperatures result in high oil viscosities. And if you look at the pictures in the upper right of that slide, for example, the 19-degree API crude on the left flows at the consistency of cold olive oil or maybe maple syrup, and the 10-degree API crude on the right flows more like molasses. So looking at those pictures, it's not too hard to imagine that the kind of thick viscous oil going through a tiny pore space in the rock results in low rates and recovery factors lower than what could typically be achieved in a light oil reservoir or a gas reservoir. Next slide. is a real busy slide, and I won't go into excruciating detail, but it's a net pay map of the West Sac Reservoir, and you can see that it extends north into the BP-operated Milne Point area and east into the greater Prudhoe Bay, Satellites Polaris, and Orion. The West Sac Reservoir is not a new reservoir. It was actually discovered in the early 70s. There was a pilot project conducted in the early 1980s. However, commercial development didn't take place until the late 1990s, even though there was plenty of room in the TAPS pipeline well before then. The initial developments in 97 and 98 involved vertical wells and 40-acre well spacing, but by 2004, long multilateral wells were becoming the predominant well design for accessing the heavy oil resources on the slope. Currently, within the Kaparuk River unit, we have about 80 wells producing in West Sac. They're split about 40 producers, 40 injectors, and we make about 16,000 barrels a day. So on average, about 400 barrels a day per producer. Next slide. Now, there's at least three things that all North Slope heavy oil developments have in common. We have to operate under North Slope conditions. The reservoirs are geologically complex, and we have to deal with the viscous nature of the oil. Obviously, we have to deal with the harsh Arctic conditions on the slope, and we try to minimize our footprint whenever possible to minimize impacts to the environment. The viscous oil reservoirs are oftentimes highly faulted, and because of their shallow depths and because of permafrost, they're generally unconsolidated and they have very low reservoir temperatures. The viscous nature of the oil also makes it difficult to produce from the formation, and generally various artificial lift methods are required to lift it to the surface, such as downhole pumps, for example. And viscous oils are also harder to separate from the water once you do get it to the surface, and solids handling and disposal becomes a much bigger issue for heavy oils relative to light oils. So all these things combined results in higher cost to develop and operate heavy oil fields versus light oil fields. And in addition, heavy oil fields generally have lower rates and recoveries relative to light oil fields. And in the end, the final product is less valuable than the light oil crudes because it's more difficult to refine.
So on the cost of recovery, mm-hmm. How much more, not counting the transportation costs, for heavy oil at West Sac than for your light oil or lighter oil at Kaparuk or Prudhoe? Cost-wise, is it how much more?
Mr. Chairman, I've seen it for a given year range from 2 to even 6 times higher for compared to light oil reservoirs. Again, it depends which reservoirs you're comparing to, but on a per barrel basis, it can be that much more expensive.
Okay.
Your direct lease operating costs.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Yeah, on that point, so let's take Kaparuk. So you're probably in the same pipeline system and everything else. So about what is the production cost per barrel for Kaparuk oil, and about what is that then production cost for heavy oil? Not a multiple, because depending upon factors.
I don't know exactly what the direct lift operating costs are for Kaparuk, so I can't really comment on the exact value, but
okay. Well, I'm just trying to get some range. Are we talking about $10 a barrel more? Are we talking about? I mean, can you tell us that what the differential would be instead of a? I mean, it doesn't seem like it's really going to be a multiple. It seems like it's going to be an amount more if it's $10 or if it's $6 or if it's $16 or about what your range of figures are. That's somebody didn't want to hear the answer.
We're going to take a brief Eddie's.
Sorry,
we're off the record. Sorry about that, but go ahead.
Representative Seaton, I really don't have the number, dollar figure that I can quote at this time.
Okay, and through
sure.
Follow, can you get that for us? I guess we're for a following hearing so that we So we have some comprehension for what we're talking about as far as the dollar amount?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton. Yes, we'll make an attempt to see what we can come
identify
up with.
Identify yourself. For the
oh, I'm sorry. Brian Wenzel, no. ConocoPhillips. Yes, we'll make an attempt at seeing what we can disclose and provide that information.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Spencer.
All right. let's see. So basically, again, the main points are the heavy oil developments are typically higher cost. You get lower rates and recoveries, and you get lower price for your product in the end. And in fact, if it weren't for the rapid advances in horizontal drilling and multilateral technologies over the past several years, much of the heavy oil development on slope, the fields there would probably still remain idle at this point. If you'll go to the next slide. As an example, this next slide shows the recently completed WESAC 1E development, what it would look like if we were drilled from downtown Anchorage. So if we started at the ConocoPhillips Tower, looking at 1E-102 well, where we drilled 2 8,000-foot laterals, it would reach about 3 miles north beyond the Port of Anchorage. And a different well, 1E-117, where we drilled 3 6,000-foot laterals, would extend down below about 3 miles south below Tudor Road, just as an example. And these are very difficult wells. There's been some expensive lessons as we continue to push the technical limits regarding drilling on the slope. For example, well 1E-117, the well that I show there, was drilled in 2005, and it cost over $12 million, and that was versus our planned cost of $8 million. So there's definitely significant financial risk to these wells.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Chair. We have this little model with different viscosities. We have something beyond that, which is beyond the word. Is all oil heavy oil, or is there something that you simply refer to some other way, like with the consistency of concrete? What would that be called heavy oil, or is that?
That'd be really, really heavy oil.
Well,
it would be tar. It'd be like
something.
It would be asphalt or a.
I mean, where it just crumbles, but it won't flow. Right. Period.
Yeah, like tar sand. We actually have to mine them.
Okay, so that's outside of when you talk heavy oil, that stuff on top of crude oil, which I think is the consistency of asphalt. We're not talking about that. We're talking something thinner than that. Am I correct?
Typically, in the WESAC, the stuff that we're currently producing out of the WESAC Trader Bluff formations, that is correct.
Oh, who's there?
Point of clarification, the bill is the way it's structured currently could include a tar sand, something you can pick up and throw it to your son. So, and there's been testimony about what's called tar mats, which is residual oil in the bottom of holes and so forth. So there's a distinction based on depth and on gravity in the bill right now. So conceivably you could be doing that. It's much more uneconomical and difficult to deal with. More like the bitumen in Alberta, where you drive a big, huge dump truck up to it and you backhoe it into the truck and drive it to a refining point. So.
Yeah, and I knew that. I just wondered if we went beyond that. Because when I think of what's been described as on top of Pluto, that is not available to us at this time, correct? We don't have technology pull that out of the ground. And that's what I'm trying to find out.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto, are you referring to a specific reservoir or formation?
What's been described to me is there's Prudhoe Bay, and then higher up, there is heavy, and they use the word heavy, and that's what I'm trying to find out, is the word heavy encompass something that is solid? And oil will flow. We had API 30 here. It flows. But this stuff, you turn it on its side, nothing happens. That's what I'm wondering, if that's what we have on Fugo. Or is that proprietary?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto, I'm not exactly sure what formation you're talking about. It's potentially the Ugnew formation. The Ugnew oils can be in the range of 8 to 12 degrees API, gravity. Generally, anything less than 10 is considered bitumen, as an example.
So Ugnew is 8?
It can range from 8 to 12. Next slide, please. The next slide just shows a plan view of the 1E development on the left and the ongoing 1J development on the right. Those circles have a radius of 15,000 feet or just under 3 miles. As you can see, as difficult as the 1E wells were, we're once again pushing the limits on 1J development. I should note that there are longer extended reach wells drilled in the world, for example, Witch Farms in the UK. But as far as I know, they don't typically drill multilateral wells. And also, they don't have the complicated geometry shown here. And what I'm talking about there is basically taking a 90-degree turn. That increases the complexity of the wells.
Do you use the same technology now for standard oil? I mean, for probably a bad term, standard oil, to use in front of you guys. But how about for light oil? I mean, do you use the 90-degree turns and the same technology that you're using right now? Because I'm going to tie it back in a couple of minutes to Mr. Wenzel and the question on the R&D. It's the same technology used everywhere, and at heavy oil, it's just still the weight of the oil is still the problem, or is it it's completely different technology and different recovery methods used?
Mr. Chairman, we use the same type of directional drilling, for example, at Alpine.
Okay.
The difference with Alpine is the rock's more competent and it's deeper, which makes it relatively easier to drill than the shallower, unconsolidated formations in the West Sac.
Okay, thank you.
And another point to keep in mind is that some of the longer reach wells that are drilled from around the world are drilled with very, very large rigs that wouldn't be suitable for use on the slope due to our unique conditions where we try to minimize our footprint relative to the size of our drill sites, our roads and bridges and so forth. So it's just important to keep that in mind when you compare it apples to apples when you're looking around at what kind of drilling technology is available in the world today. The next slide.
Just for some clarification, I know on shallow natural gas, you know, they've gone to this kind of directional drilling technology in the shallower depths as well. Is that the same basic technology then that you're using here as what's been developed for shallow natural gas? Or do you know?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Seaton, I would assume, you know, we have a global, the oil industry is a global business, and the drilling technologies that are developed in one area are applied to other areas when applicable. And so if something new is developed for the West Sac Reservoir that would work in a shallower gas reservoir somewhere in the world, it's probably going to be applied by the service companies that actually do the drilling.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Roper.
Good Chair. Spencer, looking at the West Sac spider map, 1E versus 1J, you mentioned you're looking at about 400 barrels a day per well bore or hole. What types of, with this expanded spider drilling, what type of production are you getting out of these particular pads?
Representative Roberg, the 400 barrel average is all of our producing wells, which is a mixture of vertical and single lat, dual lat, and tri lats. For some of our trilateral wells, we've reached rates of 1,500 to 2,000 barrels a day. Yeah. The next slide is basically the Alaska extended reach drilling envelope. And what I mean by that, and I won't again go into excruciating detail, but it's not only the length out from the surface location that creates the difficulty in drilling a well, it's also how deep it is. And so what's called the aspect ratio is the horizontal displacement divided by the true vertical depth. So if you drill the well 12,000 foot out at a depth of 4,000 feet, it would be a 3-to-1 ratio. And as that ratio increases, the difficulty of drilling that well increases because you have a lot more frictional forces to try to push it out, and you don't have the weight of the drill pipe to help push it down. And the point that I'm trying to make here is that prior to 1990, there was no wells drilled in Alaska with a greater than a 2-to-1 ratio. Even before 2000, there was no wells drilled greater than a 3-to-1 aspect ratio. The Nyakuk wells I've shown out here that are out at about 20,000 feet are typically at a depth of around 9,600 feet, and so that ratio is around 2, which actually makes them somewhat easier to drill than our current wells that we're drilling at West Sac, which are kind of circled up there towards the top that show the 2005 wells that show aspect ratios greater than 3 and even a bit over 4 in some cases.
Representative Gatto?
Thank you. I know it's hard to do in Alaska, need bigger rigs, but typically in a good environment, what's a great aspect ratio?
The Representative Gatto, in which farms I believe they're in the neighborhood of drilling 35,000 feet at about 5,000 foot depth, so it would be like a 7-to-1 ratio. I don't believe that they're drilling multilateral wells there, and I'm not completely familiar with it, but I also don't think that they do some of those 90-degree turns that we do on the slope.
If I can continue, so I'm just a little curious, since it gets more and more difficult to build them horizontally out, but times change, technology changes, we probably used to be 1-for-1, 1-for-1.5, now we're 1-for-4. Do we anticipate in 10 years in Alaska we'd be at 1-to-5, 1-to-6? In other words, can we get better in Alaska under the same conditions that we have today, or are we at the limit?
Representative Gatto, we're currently are at the limit, and we'll continue to try to push that limit as new techniques and new ideas are implemented on the slope. Eventually, you're going to reach a physical limit. I mean, physics will prevail, and you won't be able to overcome the frictional forces. And so there is a limit out there. What I'm currently showing you on this plot is what the current limit is. And they're not, like I said, they're not easy wells to drill.
Thank you.
To flip to the next slide, this is what I mean by a current completion for a West Sac well. It's called a trilateral producer. We basically have three relatively horizontal wells drilled into three different sands, the D sand, the B sand, and the A sands. You notice that in the A sands, we sometimes undulate between the two sands if there's enough sand there that we think is profitable to dip into, and it saves us from having to drill a quadrilateral. The box in the upper right is meant to indicate that from 1998 to 2004, 6 years, we basically changed everything about our well design and our development plans. So again, a lot of new technology was applied to try to unlock the value of West Sac. For example, we've went from vertical to wells to horizontal multilateral wells. We changed how far we can reach with our drilling rigs, changed recovery mechanisms, sand control, well spacing, mud systems, and also our production assurance program. So in all, we basically changed everything in a short period of time to try to access those resources. So there's been a lot of work done.
On a cost analysis, I mean, has it been successful? Are you glad that you've switched all of these methodologies? Have your costs decreased?
Mr. Chairman, the jury's still out on some of the changes that we've made. It's still early days on the horizontal multilateral wells, I mean, compared to the number of vertical wells that were drilled in the late 90s. We're just now approaching sort of an equivalent number of multilateral wells to compare them against, but we don't have the reservoir performance. There's not been enough time to get adequate reservoir performance from the trilaterals to see if it's really been worth the money, you know, to conclusively say that.
Okay. And one follow-up, if I could also, is have you also changed your production as drastically on your other fields that are not heavy oil? Have you pretty much changed your entire company's philosophy for the North Slope, or for maybe company globally, on some of the methodologies you use for oil recovery? Or did you pretty much tailor what you've outlined here in this diagram? Is this pretty much specific for heavy oil recovery?
Mr. Chairman, I think the general trend, not only on the North Slope, but probably in the industry, is to go more and more towards horizontal wells, whether it's a light oil reservoir, or gas reservoir, or heavy oil reservoir. And as an example, Alpine is the first field in the world that was drilled up completely with horizontal wells.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Rammers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question on behalf of a constituent, actually, and it's applicable for this. Where else are you doing heavy oil extraction? What other part of the world?
Representative Emerson, ConocoPhillips has operations in Venezuela, Canada, China, Russia. That's probably the majority of it.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, here's my question. This is the constituent question that I got. Was they said, well, why don't we just leave the oil there for a decade or longer and wait till it's less expensive to extract it from the ground? It's not particularly that point of view that I have, because I'm pro-resource development today. But it is a constituent question that came up a couple days ago, and I didn't know how to answer the question. It, because of the technology advancements, presumably, you were just talking about how well, the manner in which you do these wells has been improving. How should I answer a constituent in that question?
Representative Ramos, I guess a couple of things. Basically, the laws of economics prevail on supply and demand. So the more oil that can be produced, hopefully the price for the consumer would be lower. If you leave more oil in the ground, reducing the supply, so then therefore the price would go up. That's one thing. The second thing is that we have a basic infrastructure on the slope, and light oil production is declining on the slope from Prudhoe, from Park, and so forth. Yet you have a fixed cost to maintain that infrastructure. As an example, the TAPS was built for 2 million barrels a day, and now is down to 1 million a day. It's going to continue to go down, and there might be a point that it no longer becomes economic to operate. And if you don't backfill that with heavy oil production on the slope, that's really the resource on the slope to continue to fill that pipeline is the heavy oil.
The question that I had was more specific, and that was just related to the cost of extracting heavy oil. I'm with you on all the mechanics and economics of that. Their question was real straightforward, which is, if it costs so much to get the heavy oil out now, why not wait a decade until the technology is better and it's less expensive to extract heavy oil? They weren't looking at it as part of an overall North Slope strategy. Their question was specifically the higher cost extraction of heavy oil. There's not a trick question. I'm not. Brian, I wouldn't do that.
Brian Wenzel, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ramirez. I think actually Jeff is answering that question in the sense that it is a policy call on the part of Alaska and the legislature in terms of whether you want to develop this oil now, whether you want to help develop the technology to extract this resource. To the extent that Alaska determines that it has sufficient production, it doesn't need to fill the line, it doesn't need to stem or mitigate production decline, yes, Alaska could make that option or take that option. We would not recommend it. We think instead, and I think the DOR has presented charts in the past showing the dramatic decline in production, and only, I think, Alaska's overall revenues have only been saved, if you will, by the fact that oil prices have increased, which has resulted in sufficient oil-related tax revenues. Am I still not answering your question, Representative Remmers?
I mean, their question was a lot simpler than that. But their question was, why not just book it simply as heavy oil reserves and wait till it's cheaper to extract heavy oil? I mean, it was a very simple question they asked me, and I gave them the same answer you did, and it resulted in an unsatisfactory answer.
Representative Remmers, there's also no guarantee it will get cheaper in the future with new technology.
That's what I told them.
That was a good answer, then.
Right. The price might drop. Representative Seaton.
There won't be any pipeline to put it through.
I'm pro-resource, Mr. Chairman. I'm with you.
Thanks. If this is the same technology you're using for the light oil fields and all around as well now, And if we're getting production out of these in heavy oil at 1,500 to 2,000 barrels a day, where is the, I'm trying to figure out where the technology cost is or where the cost is that requires us to give an additional 15% credit to develop these. I mean, 1,500 to 2,000 barrels a day on a well is pretty good production. And if it's the same technology that is now going to be employed on most of the new fields that are being produced, whether it's light or heavy, where I'm trying to figure out, is it the gas lift back? I think we're doing gas lift back on light oil fields as well, aren't we? And or is it the oil based instead of the water based mud system? Is that the difference in this field versus the other, or you know, is it the chemical? I'm trying to figure out where our economics are so disparate between the development that we use for other oil.
Representative Seaton, you covered a lot of ground there. I'll see if I can answer that question. As one example, I mentioned earlier that you get a lower recovery from a heavy oil field than you would do from an equivalent light oil field. And what I mean by that is places like Prudhoe and Alpine are getting more than 50% recovery of the reserves that are in place. Whereas for a heavy oil development, we hope at WESAC to get between 15 and 20%. UGNU, which is even heavier, is probably, if we ever develop it at all, would probably be in the neighborhood of 5 to 8% recovery. So even though there's a lot of oil there, the efficiency of getting out of the ground is much, much less. Therefore, your per unit cost of getting that out of the ground is much, much more. And I've got a few more slides down.
And just to follow up, but that would be dependent on field size, right? If you had a large field of heavy oil at 20% recovery, you might actually be recovering more oil than if you had a smaller field that you were developing of light oil, even at 50%. Is that right?
Yeah, from a total barrels perspective, that could be the case. One of the things it might be, though, you may have to drill two or three times as many wells to get the same amount of reserves out of the ground in the heavy oil case, because it doesn't flow as well underground.
Okay, thank you.
I guess we can probably go to the next slide there. That schematic of the trilateral is basically a cartoon, and it was kind of an idealized trilateral well, but this shows a more realistic representation of how one actually looks after it's drilled. And as you can see, we usually have to cross multiple faults and still stay within a very tiny window of the formation from 20 to 50 feet, even while we're reaching out to lengths of, in this case, 13,000 feet horizontal displacement. Like I said, it may not exactly be rocket science, but it comes pretty close in technological complexity to drill these wells. Next slide. Once the well is drilled and the oil is brought to the surface, usually by the means of a downhole pump or other artificial lift method, there still remains other issues with producing heavy or viscous oils. This slide shows the samples of produced water from CPF-1 and CPF-2. And as you can see, the water from CPF-1, where the WESAC developments are taking place, contain much more entrained oil and will require more heat and or chemicals to separate, and that results in a higher operating cost for heavy oil versus a light oil reservoir. Next slide. If the fluid separation problems weren't bad enough, other problems with producing heavy viscous oil from shallow, unconsolidated reservoirs is solids production. The viscous nature of the crude creates a lot of drag or frictional forces in the reservoir, and it tends to pluck out the sand grains and solids from the reservoir and then transport them to the surface. The solids shown here generally have the consistency of glacial silt or mud, The pictures I've shown here, we're basically sucking it out of these tanks, trucking it over to the grind and inject facility at Prudhoe, and that all adds to the operating costs of heavy oil when we generally don't have to do that for light oil development.
You don't have to do any of this for light oil development? Any of this procedure that you've got photographed here?
Representative Samuels, the frequency is greatly increased when you're dealing with a heavy oil reservoir. you know, there's still occasionally some solids production in light, but it's very, very minimal. And a lot of this equipment that's been installed at CPF-1 has been just since we've produced the West Sac Reservoir.
Okay, thank you.
And yet another problem with transporting solids along with your fluids is that it greatly increases equipment wear. And it'd be just like having dirty oil in your car would increase the wear and tear in your engine. It's the same thing with producing viscous crudes from downhole. And abrasive fluids are particularly tough on rotating equipment like surface and downhole pumps. And so you have to replace them much more frequently in a heavy oil reservoir than you would equivalent light oil reservoir. Next slide. So that was just meant to basically give you a little overview of why the commonalities in the heavy oil developments on the North Slope. Again, we have to operate under North Slope operating conditions. They're geologically complex, and we have a viscous nature of the oil. It leads to higher operating costs, lower rates and recoveries from the reservoirs, and I said ultimately a lower product price. Next slide. To date, the West Sac development within the Clark River unit has been confined to the core area, or what we call the sweet spot of the reservoir, and that's the area that's outlined here in green. It encompasses drill sites 1B, 1C, 1D, and 1E. We're also in the middle of an ongoing project at 1J.
So as you go through exploration, does the seismic tell you what type of oil you're looking for? I mean, do you have a clue before you drill a well? This is heavy oil down here, and I need to make arrangements economically for that, or I'm not going to drill here because the seismic tells me it's that, or do you know before you start spending money what type of oil it is?
Mr. Chairman,
no guarantees in the world.
Mr. Chairman, we generally have an idea based on offset wells or the depth of that the reservoir that you're targeting is located. We do a lot of regional studies with the geology and try to figure that out in advance to see if it is worth going after. So there's at least an idea or a concept of what kind of oil might be in the ground. But until you actually put the bit to it and get some actual samples, you never really know.
So if getting back to the tax credits in the legislation, if the seismic told you that it was going to be heavy oil or light oil, either way, is it public information, the cores that you, does DNR have access to that, or DOR have access to the cores that are brought up in a particular area for your well 1C or 1D here? I mean, if your seismic tells you, and the seismic is public and the state gets to look at it and they go, we all agree it's heavy oil, and then you drill well number 1D and it's not heavy oil, but we've given you a tax credit for that drill rig, is that core that you pull up there, is that public information? Does the state have access to all of the information?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not 100% sure if the state does have access to that information. Sometimes that stuff is confidential. But
you can see our concern.
I don't believe that you can necessarily tell if it's heavy oil or light oil from seismic.
Sure.
You'd have to, again, get a fluid sample, and make your measurements from that.
And is it a different type of well when you first explore? You get some seismic and you say, okay, I'm going to drill right here, and you drill down and you have some sort of core that comes up, or you get more information from what you drilled right there. Is the same type of drill rig you used? Doesn't really matter what you expect to find, heavy oil or light oil. It's the same. Your initial well is the same type of equipment, or do you need something different for? If you expect heavy oil, do you have a different piece of equipment in there, which is then more expensive, and so your operation costs them to go up, even though you're not sure what's down there? I don't know if I'm making my question clear or not, but
Mr. Chairman, essentially, you use the same drilling rig. A lot of the tools don't work as well to obtain a fluid sample in a heavy oil reservoir than it would in a light oil reservoir. For example, there's a tool called an MDT that works very well in a light oil reservoir, not so good, say, in the Agnew reservoir. Therefore, we have to do an additional step there and run sidewall cores, which is more expensive to get the same data that you could in a light oil reservoir.
And if you were doing your first exploratory well, you would do what you expected to find, the expensive one or the cheap one?
We often have a well plan, and then as we drill the well, we have to modify it depending on what we actually see. So we do have, typically, if you're going to go to the cost and expense of drilling an exploratory well, you're going to have a fairly extensive data gathering plan. I mean, it'll consist of running electrical logs to try to determine the various formations, perhaps fluid samples, perhaps cores.
Okay. And I guess we can ask DNR the access issue that we'd be concerned about. Thank you. Representative Seaton.
But just following up on what you were talking about, Mr. Chairman, but basically when you do an exploratory well, you're going to do a whole logging set and a whole data recovery set on no matter which, I mean, it doesn't matter what you're targeting at that point in time on an exploratory well, you're going to do an entire log set and to find out everything in that structure. Is that correct? I mean, it doesn't matter whether you expect light oil or heavy oil there in an exploratory sense.
Representative Seaton, I'm not 100% sure I understand your question, but I'll give you an example. We recently completed a couple of appraisal wells that were targeting West Sac Reservoir, and we also got information on the Ugnew formation as well, which sits above it. We did get logs through that. We got fluid samples and cores, sidewall cores, in those zones, so we could evaluate the development potential in that area. It can be very variable between the different fault blocks. If you look at that one map, in fact, I think we're still on that page, all those lines are basically faults, and the oil quality within a fault can be different, but it also can, or it could be water as well. And so if we don't have a penetration telling you that there's actually oil there in the ground, you know, you wouldn't go off and develop it without knowing that information. So the main point of this slide I wanted to throw out is that ConocoPhillips would like to continue development of the eastern West Sac area. And what that means is we'd like to maintain our base production from drill sites 1B, C, D, and E. We'd like to complete the 1J development. And then our strategy has been to basically develop the relatively easier stuff first, the stuff in the core area that's outlined in green first, and then work towards progressively harder areas. So assuming that we had a stable fiscal environment and that we can continue to push the limits of technology, we'd like to move forward with developments on the northeast West Sac area, or what we call the NEWS area. It's outlined here in red. And the NEWS development is envisioned to be a series of projects that in total could range more than $1 billion and could potentially be developed in the next 5 to 7 years. But again, there we'll have to push beyond what we're currently doing, even at 1J, to make that an economic project. Further into the future and beyond that, there would be the Western West Sac and the shallower Ugnew developments, if Ugnew ever becomes economic to develop. Next slide. And I really hope that ConocoPhillips and its partners can move forward with these projects because the size of the prize is so large. Even if we're successful in pushing the limits on technology to develop the NEWS area, which at this point we envision essentially just expanding current technology even beyond what it's currently capable of doing, it still leaves a substantial target for the future. The Western West Sac and Ugnew resources will certainly take new technology development and modifications to existing technology to allow development in our unique operating conditions on the slope, again, with permafrost issues and Arctic environment and so forth.
Representative Gatto had a question.
Yeah, a question that kind of goes back to both the co-chairs. And it's a little more involved, but it says this, essentially. I've read reports that said, 300,000 barrels per day through the pipeline it becomes uneconomical to operate, and oil companies probably quit producing. But that's Prudhoe Bay oil, which is we call light oil. If indeed we run low on light oil and we start producing heavy oil, and you try to run 300 or more thousand barrels a day through the pipeline, is there a different threshold that says, and I'm not sure what the first one threshold being 300,000, because it depends on the price, but we've got to establish some parameters or we can't talk about anything. Is heavy oil going to say, if 300,000 barrels a day is the limit for light oil, is 400,000 barrels or 500 or 600, heavens knows what, the limit for heavy oil? Does it cost more to get, more to ship, lower price? How much more oil do you need? Because I'm trying to look at what is going to be the motivation for pushing for heavier oils if indeed we don't have enough to push through the pipeline. Is that something that we're aware of?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto, I don't know what the answer to that question is as far as a threshold on when taps would become uneconomic in a heavy oil environment. I do know that it'll become uneconomic sooner if we don't develop the heavy oil resources, because it's basically a total volume through the pipeline. And if we can really expand the heavy oil development on the slope, you're going to push out that time before we fall below some threshold, whatever it is, whether it's 500,000 or 300,000, by putting more wells in the ground and moving more oil off the slope through the pipeline and into and to be sold on West Coast markets.
Can I continue?
Yes.
And this goes back to Co-Chair Rambers' question that he got from his constituent. Why not leave it there? Well, the immediate response to me was, because if that's all we have later on, it may not be worth going after. But if we can get it now, it is worth going after. And then number two, if you mix heavy and light in the pipeline, you wind up with something that moves better than just heavy. So on several fronts, hurry up.
Yeah. I concur.
Okay.
Let's see. Just for those stated reasons, I think that developing the heavy oil resources on the slope would be good for everyone. It'd be good for ConocoPhillips and its partners, the many service companies that support our industry, and also for the state of Alaska through increased royalties, corporate income tax, and so forth. If you go to my last slide, in summary, there's basically vast heavy oil resources on the slope. Potentially, there could be 4 to 5 billion barrels ultimately recovered from the slope. And development will be key to minimizing the production decline from the Alaska North Slope. These resources are definitely challenged. They're technically complex, high cost, low rate, and recoveries, and lower wellhead values. And we believe that fiscal incentives could encourage heavy oil development. And so ConocoPhillips supports this bill and believes that it could be beneficial in accelerating investment in challenge oil opportunities in Alaska.
Thank you very much. What we're going to do is we can take some questions. And we've also got Mr. Paskvin online, the engineer for BP. What I'd like to do is, we did have people fly into town specifically to testify on House Bill 306, so I've got some questions actually for Mr. Wenzel, and then what I think we'll do is if we can keep a quorum here, is extend the meeting maybe for an hour from 3 until 4. We'll take up 306 as soon as Representative Stoltz arrives, and then we will come back to the heavy oil and get to Ms. Wilson's testimony. That's okay with everybody. I don't know what everybody's scheduled. I know you've got a bill up. You can come back.
I'm your wingman, Mr. Chairman.
Take a breath out of you. We got two. After the oil and gas meeting, and if we go to page 3 of the bill on that number B on line 19, that research and development is a concern of mine. And I think you can, just by me bringing it up, you can tell what the question is. Do you have patents on techniques, or anything? I can't imagine that you do on a technique. But if we're going to pay for something that's used around the world, I want to know who else is paying for it. What type of R&D do you consider on a corporate level? You told me that you had a mini refinery and a mini this, and if you could just kind of go into and how your view of the world in R&D, and then maybe Representative Roper can speak on it, and then I'm going to ask Ms. Wilson. But I've got a huge concern with having R&D with really a very difficult to check from the state's point of view on giving a credit on that. But if you could comment on that.
In general, I do want to talk about this language here. But I guess before we get to that, the conversation that I think Jeff and I had previously was the fact that we often try and be very open in terms of sharing technologies, doing knowledge sharing with our competitors in order to advance in this area. So I don't know that there's a lot of patent activity going on in that sense. I understand the concern that the committee may have, that Alaska may have, about research and development, how much of that should be funded effectively through credits like this. But at the same time, as we discussed previously before the Oil and Gas Committee, this research is going to get done somewhere, somehow, by someone, and then it's going to get shared. My view is that Alaska should be on the leading edge of that. We've got heavy oil. We've got it in known resources. We should be there. This language that's drafted in the bill, my interpretation of this language is it's broader than just R&D. It is research, yes. It's feasibility studies. It's pilot testing. It's development of heavy oil projects to the point of commercialization. Excuse me. With respect to how we treat R&D generally, yes, we have a research center down in the lower 48 where a lot of our sort of blue sky R&D is done. It turns out in recent years we actually started allocating those costs out to upstream and downstream just at a very high level, even though it's blue sky and hasn't been specifically requested for a particular project. It does get allocated out to sort of force our various regions and various businesses to recognize the value of R&D. That said, I think what we would recommend for this bill is that you go after a trigger or a threshold that looks at sort of approved projects related to heavy oil or non-conventional oil, where in fact the Department of Revenue can go to that project approval document and see what costs were expected, what should be included, how those relate to overall costs going on the North Slope. And to that end, yes, we do have the ability if we identify a project up here, we want to develop what we think is going to be new technology, we need some real help, we can go to our technology services group, commission a project, there will be a scope, it will get approved, it'll have a finite scope, as I say, that can then be checked against what we actually expend. And so, yes, there could be costs in that sense coming out of the lower 48, which would be very definitely related to a project here in Alaska, which I know as this is drafted right now, it's out of state, it wouldn't be covered. But I guess my point is that I think you can overcome maybe some of your fears about R&D expenditures by focusing on sort of approved projects. Again, recognize that a lot of this resource is a known resource. It's in areas already covered by joint ventures where we're going to have partners who have to approve this. It's not going to be just ConocoPhillips coming up with a bunch of expenditures on R&D that we're going to sneak in here and get credits for through Alaska. Rather, it's going to be approved by our partners, who, again, are going to provide a very high level of scrutiny and diligence to that process.
Okay. Thank you. Any more questions? And I don't know if Mr. Spencer, are you down here just for this hearing? Are you down here for the other small bill that's floating through the legislature?
He'll be happy to stay, Mr. Chairman.
We'll hold the bill, but until tomorrow afternoon. But I don't know. You're more than welcome to call in. That's up to you and your boss. So anyway, for right now, we're going to kind of switch gears a little bit. Yes, Representative Roper.
What was your schedule for the rest of the day, Mr. Chairman? If we have other witnesses,
we're going to take care of 306 right now. Witnesses that were online, Mr. Paskman from BP is online to answer questions. Mr. Van Dyke is online from the Division of Oil and Gas, and Ms. Wilson is here from tax. So I'd like to get back to the bill if we can go a little bit late and at least flesh out some of the testimony, particularly DOR's some of their concerns.
May I suggest we have a time certain, or are you comfortable with doing that? For the witnesses, for convenience.
I don't know. Let me see how this next bill goes. I said people flew into town just to testify on this bill, so I want to make sure that we accommodate those people that came to Juneau just to testify on 306. So let's start getting through 306 and see where that leads us. But it's going to be at least a half an hour, at least. So, Ms. Wilson, if you want to come, we won't start anything with you before 3. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Nice. You're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Stoltz? Here's the guy who flew.
May Mr. Mulligan join me?
Yes.
We have
through the public. Yeah. Okay.
We have Representative Stoltz and Ben Mulligan are here, and we're grateful to have you introduced House Bill 306. We have a gentleman, Ron Swanson, the Director of Community Development from Palmer, has flown in, so we want to hear from Ron after your introduction, and then we've got some degree of public testimony. Looks like about half a dozen people that we'll want to take testimony from, and then see where we can get on this, Representative Stoltz. So with that, is this a CS? Do we need to adopt?
Mr. Chairman, we're on the F.
Yes.
As in Frank. Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt 24-LS0907/F Bullock, the CS for 306 as a working document.
Okay. Without objection, version F is adopted. Representative Stoltz.
Jordan. Thank you, Chairman Ramirez and Chairman Samuels. This bill I introduced at the request of the Matanuskas who sit in the borough last spring, and with the hope that there'd be some public discussion by the borough over the summer to talk about the land exchange that they that's felt essential toward the ski and resort development project that the borough has been advancing for a number of years and seems to be moving forward. It's not totally without criticism, and I certainly have some of my own about it. It's the original public use area was passed in the 70s by then Senator Krutula and Representative Osi. It was with a lot of community support, and I wanted this on the table so that the borough could make the appropriate advocacy of why it's essential for this project. There's certainly some changes I want to recommend with the support of the committee. Two things I would like to include is language that I had talked about publicly, and that was some setback from the Little Susitna River, which at one point the parties involved said it wasn't. It was a non-starter because it would doom the project, and then subsequently have said, well, no, it's a reasonable change. So things evolve. That would be a change I would support. And I don't know if my staff has passed the amendments for your consideration at the appropriate time. And the other is I would really like to have a public vote on this one, so because of the scope and size of this whole development that the people of Mat-Su actually get an investment in this project and have it explained to them and what the scope of it is and what their skin in the game is. And that's I'm for a lot of public process, but those are I'm the facilitator as a representative for the Mat-Su borough down here, and putting this on the table, the advocates the people that are advocating for the borough and for the developers can certainly speak with more zeal and passion. I think it's an issue that has merit for the legislature to address. This is a project that's been talked about for a number of years, and it's run into obstacles as a lot of large projects do. And there's some other vehicles moving through the legislature that have a chance to make this successful. But But like everything, the pieces of the puzzle have to fit together. Then Representative Gatto's district, and he may have comments on it. But with that, I'll yield to any questions, but probably more appropriately yield to people who can speak with authority about details.
Thank you, Representative Stoltz. Are there any questions for Mr. Stoltz? In the interest of time, then, I think we'll invite Ron Swanson up. Thank you both for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ron Swanson. I am the Director of Community Development for the Mat-Su Borough. As I call it, in a previous life, I was also the Director of Division of Lands back in the 1990s. So I've worked this particular issue on Hatcher Pass, both on the state side and now on the municipal side. So it's been around a while. This legislation that's before you would make 200 acres available under our municipal land entitlement. The Mat-Su Borough has an entitlement of 355,000 acres, roughly, which has not been fulfilled. That was a promise made by the legislature back in 1979. We are working our way. We're getting very close to that. But we're very particular, I guess, in the type of land that we're trying to get, making sure that we meet a variety of needs, recreational needs, economic needs, et cetera. We consider this 200-acre piece an important piece of our economic development picture or portfolio. Transfer of this land is consistent with the Municipal Land Act. It provides for the transfer for two municipalities to encourage economic growth and self-sufficiency. But because the land is currently located within a legislatively designated area, a public use area, it takes action by the legislature to make that possible. As Representative Stoltz mentioned, the Hatcher Pass public use area was established by the legislature in 1986. In its entirety, it's about 5,200 acres. The 200-acre piece we are seeking is at the far, far southern end of this particular parcel. The area was established for three principal reasons: to provide public recreation activities, protect and enhance fishery and wildlife resources, including fishing, grazing, hunting, and trapping, and protect the water quality and scenic resources of the area. The public use area basically follows the Lewis-Sitton River from the start of the Hatcher Pass area all the way up into its headwaters. To the east of this particular public use area is another very large legislatively designated area, the Madison Moose Range. So plenty of habitat is being established there. In 1989, at the request basically of a developer from Japan, Mitsui, the Hatcher Pass Management Plan was adopted and amended to provide for the development of the Government Peak subunit of the Hatcher Pass Management Plan for a ski area. And this included residential development and some commercial development, and a lease was subsequently issued to them. The lease included the land that we are talking about today. It included the land within the public use area. Since the public use area was adopted and the management plan amended, the state's the Department of Natural Resources have turned over the development of the ski area and project to the borough. The borough has assumed complete management ownership of the lease for the area, and we've obtained ownership to the area outside of this, so it encouraged the development as well. There are maps in your packet to lay all that out to show these particular areas, and if there's any questions, I'll be glad to help you understand the maps better. We continue to make steps to make Hatcher Pass a reality. We want to make sure it's developed at a level of quality, and the environment is protected in a way that it will ensure that the values of the Hatcher Pass public use area continue, even if it is excluded from the area. For example, we are in the final stages of adopting a special land use district. This is something that's in borough code. It's basically zoning for the area. It will include setbacks of at least 200 feet from the Lewis-Sitton River, goal that Representative Stoltz wants to do. This is a draft of the SPUD right here in front of you. It includes a variety of protections for open space, watershed, buffers, wetlands, etc. We have been doing water monitoring in five different locations in the area to establish a good baseline, both quantity and quality, for the last 6 years. These type of activities we will continue to do. The Special Land Use District, or SPUD as we call it, was developed to a wide variety of citizens throughout the borough for development, active recreational users, local residents. So we're trying to make very sure that all of these various concerns are addressed. The SPUD, or zoning, will continue to make sure that full public participation continues throughout. One of the key elements of the SPUD is that before any development occurs within the area, that a master plan be developed by whoever the developer is. And the SPUD contains all the rules or all the criteria that are needed for a master plan to come before the public for review. That will go through several advisory boards, our planning commission, and our assembly for adoption before any dirt is turned in the area. This SPUD ensures that and ensures the public process. There are very strict development guidelines already in the SPUD, densities. If you look at the area for concerned development, the southern end there, there's about 3,000 acres, but no more, or approximately 600 acres of that would be actually turned into development. There's all sorts of open areas, green belts, buffers around wetland areas, wildlife transportation corridors, et cetera, included in that. As I mentioned before, there are strict environmental guidelines to go along with the development. We are requesting that you authorize conveyance of this 200 acres to the borough. We have consistently stated that the legislation before you clearly states that the transfer of this land to the borough will be subject to the Hatcher Pass Management Plan. The Hatcher Pass Management Plan, or the SPUD, goes even further than the Hatcher Pass Management Plan does, but ensures all the protections that currently exist within the public use area, other than some development that would occur, probably residential, low-density development, and some of the outer areas away from the rivers and the river areas will be protected. The borough currently owns about 3,000 acres in the area. This will be where the Alpine ski area will be located in the northern portion of the Hatcher Pass area. There will also be where the housing development, the village area development, which has been moved away from the river and more now in the center area where the Nordic ski area development will be. This will be a world-class facility. And there are lots of recreational trails, recreational walking areas, bicycling areas, et cetera, scattered throughout the whole thing. This piece is very key to the development in that it'll be actually the gateway to the southern portion of Hatcher Pass. You'll come up Hatcher Pass Road, or as Representative Donald calls it, the Palmer Fishhook Road. It has several different names. And once you get very close to the Susitna River, you'll see the pass over there on your left or off to your west. And that's where the bridge would be the entrance into the area. Other access points don't provide that visual impact, and it's, I think, very key that people have a good visual arriving viewpoint when they arrive into the area. Not that it'd be developed and billboard signs, that will never happen, but they have a good visual impact. There's areas that they can walk along, day use areas, this type of thing. Another important key is this legislation will consolidate management. Right now it's state-owned and borough-owned, and that makes it very difficult to work various parties together to manage the area that's consistently. We have worked with the Department of Natural Resources and the Hatcher Pass Management Plan. We are a co-signer of that with them. We want to continue to manage the whole Hatcher Pass area, which is very large, with them. We do it with the Division of Mining, Land, and Water and the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, and we consider it a great partnership in working with them. But when you come into development, it becomes very difficult financing-wise, development-wise, permitting-wise, to work with a variety of people. So for those reasons, we are asking that you pass this legislation that would convey 200 acres to the Matsu Borough, and it would be charged against our municipal entitlement.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Swanson?
Aye.
Representative Seat.
Thank you. I'm trying to find, your testimony was that this would remain under the Hatcher Use Pass designation, and I'm trying to find that in the bill where it says it would remain under the control of Hatcher. Okay, that's on line 15 there.
Yeah, through the chair. The conveyance to the borough would require that it be consistent with the Hatcher Pass Management Plan throughout. And what I'm saying in my testimony is we totally agree with that. We've said that all along, that we would take it subject to the Hatcher Pass Management Plan. The actual conveyance will say that. But we've even gone farther than that with in the process of adopting zoning for the area of the special land use district. It'll be much more restrictive in certain ways than the Hatcher Pass Management Plan.
Are there additional questions for Mr. Swanson? Representative Cotto.
In the back of the packet is the map, and it's got a reference to HB 306, which is in front of us. It's got an arrow leading to a shaded area. I'm just going to assume, unless you correct me, that the shaded area is the land in question.
Through the chair, Representative Garo, that is correct.
You mentioned also, if I continue.
Yes, sir.
That something about the southern boundary, but this looks like the eastern boundary. Did I hear you wrong? Or?
Through the chair, Representative Garo, it's probably me. We call this the southern portion of the Hatcher Pass development area. If you look at the other map in your packet, the bigger scaled map.
Not in my packet.
It was on your table.
This is the map I'm referring to. You should have a colored version of it. If you don't, I'll give you one. The southern portion is the southern portion. That is where the development, the residential development, the Nordic area would be. Yeah. The upper area is where the Alpine development will be. It's a different terrain. There will be no housing, commercial type development in the northern on the Alpine area. It is envisioned today. There, of course, would be a day lodge type thing, kind of an Alyeska type operation right there.
Later. Are there any other questions for Mr. Swanson? Seeing none, we thank you, and if you'll just hang with us, sir, we appreciate it. But,
thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You very much, sir. Can we go to Matt Sue, please, to John Duffy? John, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Duffy. I'm the borough manager for the Matanuska Susitna Borough. I'd like to thank you for bringing this matter before the committee for your consideration. And I'd also like to thank Representative Stoltz for introducing the bill. The borough is in support of House Bill 306 as it's presently written. It will provide 200 acres that is necessary for the economic success of the project, as Mr. Swanson has stated, provides the gateway into the project area and also lands for development. Hatcher Pass Ski Area has been a long-standing economic development project of the borough, and it would allow a public-private sector partnership to move forward. The project also fulfills the objectives of the Municipal Entitlement Program by providing for lands for economic development, diversification of the tax base, and recreational opportunities. In addition, it follows through on infrastructure improvements that the borough has made with assistance from Senator Green and legislature. We have brought in electrical power to the site. We have funded geotechnical and hydrological work. And this project would make a return on those investments. We have also completed an economic impact assessment of the proposed project. It was completed by Northern Economics, and we found that the construction cost estimates of $42 million would result in a total of 360 jobs associated to the Nordic and Alpine ski area, and approximately 1,350 jobs associated with the Southside development. As Mr. Swanson has stated, we have developed a special use district which provides land use regulations for the area. The borough presently has a 75-foot water body setback. We are setting back from the Little Susitna River. It fulfills, once again, a long-term goal of the borough, creates numerous long-term jobs, and fulfills goals of the Municipal Entitlement Program. I would like to comment on Representative Stoltz's proposed amendment on a public vote. And I just note that we would have a concern with that in that it might send a chill in other economic development projects in the borough For instance, we have the Lucky Shot Mine that is currently being reviewed and proposed for development. We have developed the port at Point McKenzie, and if we had had a public vote on that when we began, it's not likely that it would have moved forward. And so I just am concerned with that kind of requirement for this project. We believe that we have more than enough public participation in the effort. We have had a number of public hearings, and we will continue to have some in the future before this project is ultimately presented to the Borough Assembly for their consideration. Thank you once again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Duffy. Are there questions for Mr. Duffy? Representative Gatto.
Yeah, John, welcome. You said a couple statements. One was you said this land transfer is essential for the project. Did you mean essential the way I think of essential, that without it there's no project?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto, that is correct. We have talked with JL Properties about this, and they have told us, and we would agree, that these lands are essential to the success of the project. We need it for access into the property, and there are certain lands on the north side of these 200 acres that have been identified for development.
Representative Gatto?
Thank you. The other thing you mentioned was a 75-foot setback. Is that from Wasilla Creek, or I'm sorry, from the Little Sioux, or from any boundary?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto, the borough has a 75-foot water body setback that is for any water body within the borough. And in addition to that, the Hatcher Pass Management Plan already has a requirement for a 200-foot setback. So we believe that there's adequate setbacks already in place for this area.
Representative Gatto.
Just for clarification, the 75-foot setback is irrelevant when a 200-foot setback is required by the management plan.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman and Representative Gatto.
Other questions for Mr. Duffy? Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I understand, I haven't heard specific mention of what this 200 acres is going to be used for, but it sounds like it's going to be transferred to the borough, who in turn is going to transfer it to JL Properties for residential home building. Is that the case here?
Chairman, Representative Crawford, in part that is correct. Part of the area would be used for residential development. Other parts of the area would be used for access into the property. We need to cross the Little Susitna River and then enter the parent parcel. In addition to that, we have hopes that an area would be developed down there near the river where you'd have picnic benches and people would be able to walk along the river and enjoy the views.
So would the borough be selling that to JL Properties, donating it to JL Properties to make the project viable? What's the deal?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crawford, it's a little bit of both. Some of the land would be retained in borough ownership, and some of the property, particularly that property that would be identified for residential development, would be transferred to JL.
Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Duffy? Okay, thank you, Mr. Duffy. Representative Seaton had a question.
The transfer provisions or the setback provisions that you have in the Hatcher Pass Management Plan, does that mean that the land within that setback cannot be transferred?
Chairman, Representative Seekins, what it means is that there can be no development within that 200 feet. We might be able to transfer it, but even if it was transferred, that would follow in the title.
Thank you. Representative Gatto had a question.
Representative Crawford mentioned that some land would be transferred to JL Properties. Of the quantity of land we're talking about, what number of acres and what percent of the land would be released from the borough and transferred to the ownership of JL Properties?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto, I don't have a exact figure in front of me, but it's on the order of about 20%, maybe 25%.
We do have a representative from JL Properties that's coming up to testify here in a couple of minutes.
Okay.
A follow-up?
Another borough question. How about access? Does it in any way remove the access that's available now once the land is transferred?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto, it does not.
Any other questions for Mr. Duffy? Okay, next, in remaining in the Mat Sioux, Gene Woods is next.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Gene Woods, and many years ago, I worked with Senator Curtula and Representative Osi to set up this public use area, and I feel that JL Properties can go ahead and do their development without this 200 acres. I had a conversation with David Germer several months ago, and he said they only wanted about 25 acres of this 200 acres to do their commercial development. And I told them if they would leave the 200 acres alone, that I would drop all opposition to this project. And the interesting thing, in yesterday's Frontiersman, the local newspaper, there was an article asking the legislators, other than oil and gas, what was the unfinished legislative business that is most relevant to Valley citizens? Not one of these legislators mentioned Hatcher Pass. They did. One of them did mention eminent domain, and I see this as a play on eminent domain with taking land from the public in the public use area, conveying it to the government, to the borough, and they in turn will reconvey it to a private developer. And I believe a development can be done without this land. However, if they do get it, I would ask for a 600-foot setback from the creek, so that their village or economic development, their village center, would be not visible from the road. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Woods. Are there questions for Ms. Woods? Representative Gao?
Yeah, Ms. Woods, you mentioned visible from the road and setback from the creek, and I'm trying to put those two statements in one sentence. Are they the same thing, or...?
Well, if they have a 600 foot back in this area, 200 foot or 200 acre area, you would not be able to see it, their economic development, from the road.
So you're talking a setback from the road, not from the creek?
From the creek area, yes, which means you wouldn't be able to see it from the road if it was set back that much.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Woods. Are there any other questions for Ms. Woods? Seeing none, we thank you very much for your time this afternoon, Gene. Thank you for your point of view. We'll take it into consideration. Is Rob Wells there, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rob Wells. I'm the executive director of the Mat Sioux RC&D Resource Conservation and Development Organization, which is also the Alaska Regional Development Organization, the ARDER, for the Mat Sioux Borough. Our organization has supported this project since we were formed in the early 90s, and we continue to support and would support this bill, House Bill 306. The economic spinoff and recreation opportunities and that this project will bring for the Mat Sioux Valley are the real driving reasons between our support of this project. I have been a participant of the Special Planning Use District effort that is making the development standards even stricter than the Hatcher Pass Management Plan, and I think that's a good thing. I've lived in that neighborhood just south of the lease area for almost 30 years. And by conveying this 200 acres and allowing an alternate access into the southern hillside will minimize the impact in that neighborhood and also supply just a better transportation network for the project. I'd like to comment that out of the Hatcher Pass Management Plan, this ski area project will affect a few thousand acres. There are still over 200,000 acres of public use land to the north where the traditional uses in Hatcher Pass can still continue. Additionally, to the east is the Moose Range, which I approximated about 150,000 acres. So still lots of public use area available. And that would conclude my comments. I hope you support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Wells? Rob, thank you very much. There are no questions from the committee. We thank you for your time today. Next, if we go to David, is it Germer? Am I saying that properly, sir, in Anchorage with J&L Properties?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is David Germer, and I am a project manager for the Hatcher Pass project. In late 2003, J&L became involved with the Hatcher Pass project through a borough public solicitation. The solicitation was for a developer to construct an alpine and Nordic ski area. In November of 2003, J&L was selected by the borough. And over roughly a two-year period, J&L and its team of consultants have worked with the borough to develop, at this point, a preliminary project scope and financial plan. And as you've heard this afternoon, that these plans consist of three pieces. And that's the alpine area, the residential recreational community area, and a Nordic ski area and associated trails. It's important to understand that these three pieces are integrated. We believe that all three of these components of the project need to be integrated for each individual piece to succeed. From a financial standpoint, each piece is financed. As it is today, each piece is financially balanced. As such, the additional 200 acres that the borough is seeking to acquire is an integral part of the Hatcher Pass project, and at this point is necessary for financial viability. Development in this area would comply, obviously, with the borough's special use district that Mr. Swanson spoke about. In addition to the SPUD, J&L will actually be developing very specific CRNRs for development within this area. And the purpose of these CRNRs is to ensure integration of the new buildings, the infrastructure, the landscaping into their natural settings. Now, the next step for J&L Properties in regards to this project is to initiate detailed due diligence analysis, both the financial feasibility of the project as well as the project scope. And we'd like to start that work this summer. And after the due diligence and assuming financial feasibility and getting the finances for the project in place, we could hopefully begin construction of the project possibly by the spring of 2008. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Grimmer? Thank you, sir. We appreciate that. Finally, we'd like to go to Rick Thompson with DNR. Rick, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Could you state your name and your position with DNR for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Rick Thompson. I'm currently the Acting Deputy Director for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water Management in the Department of Natural Resources, and my comments will be brief. I have personally been involved with the development of the Hatcher Pass Management Plan and some of the on-the-ground management activities there over the years, and I've worked closely with the Matsu Borough on that and feel that we have moved in a positive direction all that time. And I would just like to say that the department continues to support this legislation, and I'm happy to answer any questions if I can.
Questions for Mr. Thompson? Chair Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Mr. Thompson, there's an amendment about to be offered that that has a setback from the Little Sioux up to 1,000 feet. Do you see any problems with that at all, just managing that?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, I haven't seen the amendment. I don't have any problem with setbacks per se. And I know that the special use district that Mr. Swanson talked about is dealing with setbacks as well. But I haven't seen that specific amendment, so I can't really comment on it.
Okay, I appreciate that. And just making sure that setbacks in general, if you're not going to create any sort of a problem with that. So appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Thompson? All right. Seeing that we don't have anybody else online, and we've already heard from Mr. Swenson, is there anybody else here that would like to testify on House Bill 306? Okay. He's back online. All right. Mr. Arno is back online with the AOC. Mr. Arno? Thank you. Mr. Arno, are you back? Are you with us?
Yes, sir.
Hi, how are you, sir?
Fine, thank you. Thanks for patching me back in.
Sure.
The Alaska Outdoor Council opposes House Bill 306, and the main reason for that is as we see what's happening in the valley and other areas where in South Central where we're getting more urban sprawl, those areas of state land, particularly close to that sprawl, as Hatcher Pass public use areas, becomes extremely important to us. And we see that more and more in the Outdoor Council as we try to work with Representative Stoltz in creating the Kinnick River public use area. So at this time, the Outdoor Council would rather the state land inside of the public use area in Hatcher Pass remain there. And whenever possible, it seems like as far as the public access to public resources that the Outdoor Council's had far better luck with the statutes that the state's laid down than we have with the Mat-Su Borough and their lakes management plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Arno, has there been issues with the borough? I seem to recall some issues with access to lakes and boroughs' positions that seem contrary to state positions. And I guess I don't know. Can you elaborate for me on some of the background on this?
Through the co-chair to Representative Gatto. Yes, that's a little bit what I was trying to get at as far as what's happened with lakes management plans. And those are now incorporated, that process is incorporated in the borough's coastal management plan. And what has taken place in the borough in the past is, and it's written in the regulations in the coastal management plan that way, that whenever individuals who have moved in and have bought lake property, if those individuals come together in a committee and go to the borough and ask that the lake that they now live on, if they would like it to be, they would like it to be non-motorized. And that's happened in numerous cases. And the Outdoor Council has, you know, asked the state to look at a number of those lakes that the access, motorized access, was blocked on. And at that time, you know, we were told that the state, you know, couldn't assert its authority under the Common Use Clause for waters and public access, and that if the state wanted to do something about it, they'd have to sue the borough.
Representative Gatto?
Just to continue along this line, in your opinion, would there be, if this land was transferred, would there be grandfathering rights with regard to access? Because the access really becomes a key issue if we move land from one agency, political subdivision, to another. What happens to the rights of the people that have traditionally used it?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, yes, that's, you know, that's a major concern, and the grandfather rights you know, that we're trying to see on the, be included on access trails in the Knick River public use area legislation is real cumbersome. So once, you know, once that area moves out of a public use area, then I am not sure whether the traditional access in that area, in the Hatcher Pass public use area, would be protected or not.
We're pondering on this end.
One more.
All right, Representative Gatto.
Now, Ms. Woods testified just before you that they don't need 200 acres, 25 would be enough. I think I might have the right person. I'm just trying to recall the testimony. Do you have any opinion on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gatto, I don't think we want to give up an inch of state-created public use areas close to urban areas. Thank you.
Thank you for the definitive answer. Representative Stoltz, did you have a question?
Thank you, Chairman Ramirez. And I guess there's an old story about walking dogs I heard on the House floor a few years ago. And I just want to ask Mr. Arno if he'd favor the setback language. And I think Ms. Woods might have had the Mrs. Woods might have had the number I was actually thinking of, 600 feet. But as well as a requirement of a public vote within the borough, because it is a borough entity. Do you have any position on those proposed amendments?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, yes, that the outdoor council would be agreeable. You know, the setbacks definitely, and the public process, I think, is extremely important, as again, as we've seen on the Kinnick River public use area.
Representative Stoltz, any follow-up?
No, no, that's it.
Okay, thank you, Representative Gatto.
Do we have some amendments coming that deal with setbacks or approval by the voters? And mm-hmm. I don't have those.
I have number one. I have number one and number two.
I might have them. I just don't. It's getting cluttered here. But I have them now.
You need to think ahead of ease before we do anything.
Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, are there any questions for Mr. Arno? Any additional questions? Thank you, Mr. Arno. We appreciate the point of view of the AOC is always valued here in the Resource Committee. Thank you for taking the time today, sir.
Thank you for your time.
Yes, sir. All right. With that, I think we'll taken at ease and wait for Representative Olson is going to join us. Thanks. I now have a quorum again, and we can entertain some committee discussion and or amendments. Is there committee discussion or amendments to be offered?
Chairman?
Yes?
I would move amendment number one, which starts at page 2, line following 22. It's the setback provision. It should be labeled amendment number one.
All right. And whose amendment is this?
This the sponsor of the bill.
And, Mr. Chairman, I would object for discussion.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer, you have before you a conceptual amendment, and that's a conceptual amendment to amendment number one. And I would offer that conceptual amendment that deletes 1,000 foot and inserts 600 foot. And then on line 5, after may not be improved, it inserts except for trails and may not be transferred from public ownership. And so I'd offer that amendment to amendment number one.
To amendment number one.
What was that last phrase?
And may. There in writing, but it's except for trails and may not be transferred from public ownership.
Is there an objection to the amendment to the amendment? Representative Gatto?
Question here. Mm-hmm. We're talking the one's label number 3, correct?
Yes, that is amendment to
the and right. It says page blank, line 4, and I guess that's page 1?
2.
Two?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
This was typed as conceptual amendment, but it was conceptual amendment to amendment number one.
Okay.
So this is, there's no page. Amendment number one is a conceptual amendment, and there is no page. So this is a amendment there.
Okay. Is amendment to amendment, did you maintain the...
No, I withdraw the... Yes,
no objections, friendly amendment. In the amendment to the amendment is adopted. All right?
Yeah, I've got it. Good.
So now we can delete it when he leaves, right?
He'll stock it to the next committee.
Yes, as amended. So amendment number one is before us as amended. Is who objected to that?
Representative Seaton.
Boy, are we in trouble.
Call the vote. Never safe, I'm sorry.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Secretary, can we call a vote on amendment number one, please?
Representative Gatto.
Yes.
Representative Elkins, absent. Representative Ledoux, absent. Representative Crawford.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Seaton, absent. Representative Capsner, absent. Representative Ramos.
Yes.
Representative Samuels.
Yes.
Okay, so amendment number one passes, and we have before us amendment number two.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number two. This is the amendment calling for a vote of the people.
Is there an
for
objection?
The plan transfer.
Is there an objection? Is there, would somebody like to object for purposes of discussion? Representative Crawford?
Just to ask a question.
Yes, sir.
Will this, if we put this in there, will that hurt their timeline? To the point that it would delay the project, that make it not economic, or do we know?
I don't know. Representative Stoltz, do you have any thoughts?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's a borough election coming up. There's also a primary election. There's a lot of flexibility. This can be put on a number of local or state elections, given the flexibility that our Division of Elections gives local governments. I think it's an important process. It has a multi-tiered purpose. It's a project of pretty significant scope, not just the land transfer, but other features of the project. It brings which can be described as an exciting project by a lot of people and the economic opportunities, but it's also not without some controversy, and I think it merits local discussion, not just on a land transfer, but by also gives a chance for the voters to also ask questions about the financial involvement of their local government, and it just opens up a lot of opportunities for public debate on a whole front of issues, a public process that there hasn't been on there that I would like to have, and it performs a lot of functions, but the key thing is approving the land transfer. But
thank you, Representative Stoltz. Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would it be more appropriate? Is there another point of contact with the public that you could have the vote on rather than just the simple land transfer?
I'm sorry.
Is there another point somewhere along the process where it would be more appropriate to have the vote rather than on what is essentially a simple land transfer from the state to a borough to vote of the people? I mean, obviously, it's a vote on the ski area or not. That would be what the vote would really be about. But do you see what could be a more appropriate place to have a vote?
Mr. Chairman, not one that I have any control over. That's to put it bluntly.
Fair enough. Okay.
Representative Gatto?
Just worthy of discussion, it refers to a general or special election.
Mm-hmm.
We have a special election in just about a week on May the 2nd that deals just with school bonds. That's a special election. The general election, in my understanding, is November. The primary election is August. We didn't mention elections in general, we specifically said general or special election, and I guess the question I have is the primary covered with the words general, in case it would be a good place to put it. And I don't know. In that case, we might want to add the words any election or include the word primary election as well as special and general.
Mr. Chairman, my staff specifically asked Legislative Legal to have the broadest language, and they told us that general election applies to all, although it has a specific meaning in state elections, maybe with a small g. I'm relying on the expertise of our legal division. A special election can be one outside of any other prescribed election. Municipality of Anchorage held a school bond election as a special election on the last general election ballot, state election. I mean, there are, it was my intent to have it abroad so that they could pick from a wide array of possible dates of elections occurring, or choose a special election that they would dictate the time and circumstances.
I think so. Apparently, the word general election, the word general election would cover any election without calling for something very specific to one issue, such as the school bond election that's due in a week.
Okay. Representative Crawford, do you maintain your objection?
No.
Any further objection? Seeing none, amendment number 2 carries. Are there any additional amendments to be offered by the committee? Seeing none, we have the bill before us.
Mr. Chairman, I just got a note that said the chairman wanted me right away with an exclamation point, so no, I didn't want to disrespect.
Trust us.
Thank you, folks, for your input. We appreciate it. Is there any further discussion on House Bill 306? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion.
The district.
Representative Gatto?
I'll take care of that for you, Mr. Chair, as soon as I make sure I have the letter correct. And I believe it's F?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The chair, I'll move committee substitute for House Bill 306, version F, as amended, from committee with individual recommendations, and I don't know if there are attached fiscal notes. I think I have one here, but it's a zero, so as such.
Okay. Are there any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 306 moves from committee. That gavel goes back to you, my friend. And,
okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're going to go back on House Bill 498. Right now, which would be a little more of interest, I think, to our friends from BP who are visiting us right now. And we've heard from the sponsor. We heard from ConocoPhillips. Do we still have Mr. Van Dyke and Mr. Pascavan online?
Yes, we do.
Okay. I think what we'll do now is move to Department of Revenue, to Ms. Wilson. And then we'll have some questions for DNR. Just so you know, Mr. Van Dyke, when it comes time to testify, I'm going to be asking you questions on how public is the information on exploratory well bores that are pulled out of a new exploration area. If it is anticipated that it'd be heavy oil, do you confirm that, and is that information public? But right now we're going to go to the tax division. Yes, we'll take a brief at ease. Very brief. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Robin Wilson. I'm the director of the Tax Division for the Alaska Department of Revenue. I'm pleased to offer some comments on the bill before you, HB 498. That is version Y. Overall, I see some changes have taken place in the bill since the last time I testified. And at that time, I think my comments were purposefully, general, not being exactly clear on intention. So I've tried to make my comments today a little bit more on point with specific suggestions. In the previous bill, I noted that qualified expenditures were allowable for credit, and observed that there was no definition of qualified expenditure. I understood at that time that the intention was to piggyback, in effect, off of the PPT legislation, HB 488, and that, you know, creditable definition there. With that in mind, my suggestion was to change the title of the creditable expenses in this bill to qualified capital expenditure so it would be consistent. And that's been done, but I do note now that there have been two definitions added in this bill to define qualified capital expenditure. That is one in section 026 and one in 028. And the two definitions are different from each other and different from what's in 488.
So. Thank you. We can take a brief at ease.
Wilson, tax director. I was just in the process of talking about qualified capital expenditure and how there's two definitions in the bill that are not consistent within the bill and not consistent with 488.
And where in the bill you're? I see one on page 3, line 15. And where else do you? Is it same page 3, line 10? Is that where you're?
Yes, page 3, and then also on in section 028, we have an additional definition.
Page 6, line 1.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And throughout, I mean, there is.
Okay.
There is a difference, Mr. Chairman, I think that's
the point. Representative
Roper. Mr. Chairman, Representative Roper, point Ms. Wilson's making is, I believe, is correct. There's a definition for the challenged oil, and then there's also a different definition for qualified expense for the alternate energy. And we did the CS, we're focusing on the first section and didn't really focus on the second section because they're fundamentally different. But I would appreciate the input from the department to try to make them conform them if possible. So.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Roekberg, either they can be made consistent, but I think my point might be to the extent that they are different from the definition in the PPT, which is okay, it's just I would suggest having a specific name in here rather than qualified capital expenditure. And I'm just, you know, throwing out some ideas, but, you know, one could call a qualified renewable energy expenditure for the one that's in 028 and for the one in 026 qualified challenging oil expenditure. I'm just suggesting having a different name if you're going to have a different definition.
Okay. Thank you.
The second thing I would note is in reading through particularly subsection F, where the guts of the bill are, I'm not clear on the reason for differentiating challenged and non-conventional oil. You know, clearly I'm not an engineer.
Yep. Brief that again.
My name is Robin Wilson, Director of Tax Division. Okay, I was just mentioning that I do see that there's perhaps some overlap in the term challenged and non-conventional oil. I am not an engineer, but I don't see specifically a purpose in here for the differentiation. And I would just sort of pause at this point and then go on to my next point, which is really throughout section or subsection F. There appears to be potentially a lot of overlap among the among the provisions, and I believe Representative Roekberg noted the carbonate section as perhaps overlapping. And I actually sat down and tried to do a flow chart of the provisions to figure out maybe what a particular formation or a particular gravity, whether it would be subject to the credit. And I did have some difficulty constructing a flow chart, if you will. So I provided the chairman, and I believe he's provided the members of the committee, a real sort of conceptual idea. It's not a formal, you know, suggestion. But what I am suggesting is simply sort of to have a first cut be the API gravity, and then absent that, or sort of sub pieces of that. And walking through then, and what I've done is simply take all the provisions that I see in the bill, reorganize them a little bit so that there's not the overlap. For example, if we start out at the top of my my attachment one, it appears to me the API gravity of less than or equal to 18, there's a credit. Doesn't matter where it is or how it's brought to the surface. The second sort of category would be API of between 18 and 25. And on that, it appears that it has to be on the north slope. And then you've got a choice now of the depth. Less than or equal to 5,500 feet deep, it appears that it qualifies for a credit. If we go deeper than 5,500, then we start looking at where did it come from, either a participating area or a formation. I do note that, so at this point, it's clear what's creditable. And so if any of them are taken up by EOR techniques, it doesn't add any understanding. You've already allowed that credit. So my comments in the box, those are just comments. And I've also, in a little text box, noted the paragraph, A, B, C, D, so you can tie it to the bill and see, hopefully, that I haven't left anything out. But once we go then to API of greater than 25, then you're looking at what was the average API of the oil brought out of the hole, and then certain sources, tar sands and so on. So I would just offer this as an idea perhaps of organization so that there's not the overlap either of formations or gravity. Because if you look at API of less than 25, well, that sort of includes 18 already. So I just offer that as perhaps
a way. Do you have an opinion on and I'll ask Mr. Van Dyke from DNR the same question, on instead of going with the specific gravity of the oil, instead of just going for a geographic area, if your West Sac gets the credit, Prudhoe Bay doesn't get the credit. Those types of things, which I've talked to some folks at DNR and I've talked to some people in the industry, and it would kind of simplify things a lot. Once again, if the state had access to the information as the industry got it, do you think that is simpler, or am I oversimplifying it and you'd have a hard time auditing that for as far as tax provisions go?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a particular concerns. I do have concerns when things are overlapping. So to the extent that it's simplified, either specific formations or areas as you've just identified, or sort of in this hierarchy plan, I think it would be within reason fairly easy to audit, assuming we do get access to the data.
Okay. And follow up, if you assume that PPT passes, a 488 or 305, one of the two bills passes in some semblance of the form that it's in right now with the direct cost recovery before taxation occurs, do you see a problem occurring with cost recovery on a certain type of rig if you don't do it geographically? And I guess the question might be for Representative Roekberg as well, is if you have to start testing the weight of the oil coming up to do a credit on an expenditure, but they've already taken the cost off on their taxes for that particular month, they've expended the costs, they don't know what the credit is going to be, we're having to audit the oil and the books. Do you see, because we're moving towards a method of direct cost recovery in the PPT legislation, that the entire idea should be taken care of on its own? If you have direct cost recovery, if it costs more, then you just you have more cost to recover before you start paying a tax anyway. So you already have a little bit of a benefit.
Mr. Chairman,
I rambled there without a question too much. But
well, actually, it sounded like a multi-part question, some of which I may have an answer for and some I may not.
Okay.
You are correct. Under the PPT, HB 488, because it's on a net profit basis or net value basis, you do recognize those costs that, you know, those oils that cost more to bring to the surface. That is, you know, I mean, that is the governor's proposal was as basically a balanced approach to that, and part of that was taxing on net for just, you know, part of that purpose. So, yes, we believe that 488 is a complete package and adequately recognizes it. As to measurement and so on, I would defer to Mr. Van Dyke. I think he perhaps has a little more expertise in the oil field operations.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Rookberg.
Mr. Chairman, I think if I might restate what the issue is that you posited is whether or not the PPP bill adequately covers any increased costs or investments in heavy oil or any unconventional types of oil, and therefore calls into question the necessity of having this type of legislation before us. I think the policy calls are one that I believe this is desirable because of it add additional incentives, number one. Number two, I think that we could narrow the application down to more new technology, experimental pilot type programs to add an additional incentive on top of that, which would be actually have a lesser impact dollar-wise, but would have that would perhaps clarify the status of that types of investment vis-a-vis PPT to incent more of it. But I think it would cost less to the state, if you will. And the other part of the question was, is the measurement benchmarks about using the API gravity test versus a specific formation. Now, that's a technical issue that I think that it may have significant merit, particularly if we can have a provision that allows a commissioner of DNR or the AOGCC to certify that a field did meet those standards. Because in here now we have a periodic measurement to average the API because of the potential problem if you get into any kind of horizon or pool that you could have different API levels within the same pool. So you have to take the average API to make sure it would qualify, which demands that you actually make a physical test periodically, monthly, quarterly, or whatever. Then the standard becomes what? Then the question becomes what is 25 the right API? You know, so there's been some recent discussions about just identifying the formations, for example, West Sac, Schrader Bluff, Ugnew, and even the PAs that already are established and not go with the API test. So I was trying to get it in a nutshell, but I went on longer than I intended. There's about five different issues there, though.
And I'll have some questions either from Mr. Pascvan or perhaps Mr. Hurley in a minute on some of the actual techniques and how API does it change over time and those types of things. But I'll let you finish your presentation first. And the bill's not going to move right now. The bill's going to get held over till tomorrow, and we can talk about the R&D issue, the geography versus the weight versus the method of recovery. We can discuss some of these things. So we're not in a hurry to do anything, but I'd like to get all of your comments and then maybe get to Mr. Van Dyke and then maybe ask the industry a couple more questions on their opinion on some of these things.
Okay. Moving on then, I would draw your attention to page 2 of the bill. And I'm looking at lines 18 through 28. And I would also note that there's this similar language on page 6 lines 17 through 7 through 17. Both of these sections deal with the so-called 90% safe harbor that is contained in the PPT and how that safe harbor is to be calculated. And this language includes the consideration of budgeted expenses. That is inconsistent with the 90% safe harbor in the PPT. So potentially, if these, you know, came down the line together, they were both enacted, then you would have conflicting information on conflicting rules on the 90% safe harbor calculation. So that's sort of just a technical problem with it. If we are to consider budget expenses at audit, that's a real difficult sure. audit target. My suggestion would be simply to delete those two subparagraphs.
Two subparagraphs, the entire number two, starting
the entire number two on page two, and the entire number two on page six.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a problem with that, I don't think. Just so we're consistent, if we ultimately end up with a credit that's in the definitions of the qualified capital expenses or the qualified renewable energy expenditure, if they're going to be similar to, then there's no need to have that in there. If it's adopted by amendment, you need it if it's, well, there's still a contingency effect anyway, so I think we can just delete them, as a matter of fact.
Okay, when we get to that point for CS or amendments, we will. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about down to C, the number two, down to line 28?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
And then on page six, that would be the entire number two down to C. And that includes lines 7 through 17.
Question. Are those identical paragraphs, word for word?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto.
They seem to take the same amount of room. But
I
don't finish in the same place, and that's my concern.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I don't know that I've set them side by side and done a word by word check, but they both have the problems that I was identifying.
I think they are.
Thank you.
Another question?
Yes, Representative Gatto.
When we do have conflicting language, such as if we did not address this question of numbers, this section we've just deleted, then the person paying the tax, would they be allowed to take the better for them of the two regulations, or would that be something that would have to be negotiated, or does the state pick and choose?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I don't feel qualified to answer that question. I can certainly come back tomorrow with an answer. I'd like to consult with Mr. Mintz. I believe he's been before the committee before from the AG's office.
Yes, quite some time. Representative Roekberg.
Just to clear, this bill does have a conditional effect of the act on page 8. So PPT has to pass before this is not operative. If that helps, because it conforms, the intention is to conform it with that.
Yeah. And I'm sure that question would apply in any area, not just section 2 here that we've X'd out, but just wanted to see what the procedures were when you have a conflict.
Okay.
Through the chair, I'd be happy to come back tomorrow with an accurate answer. Okay, next I would like to draw your attention to page 3, lines 19 through 21. And I believe that this has already been touched on somewhat earlier in the hearing, but I would like to note that on line 19, it allows a credit for activities incurred in the state for research. So my reading of that is if the actual research activities happen up here, that's creditable. Or, and then it goes on to say development of challenged or non-conventional oil, And that phrase, in the state, does not modify that, is my reading of the language. And then, or is a material extension of existing technology, again, is not modified by in the state. So if it is the committee's pleasure that those activities be creditable, even if out of Alaska, then it's fine. If the committee's choice is something different, then I think we need a little drafting, subparagraph.
Senator Gatto.
Thank you. And I think what you're saying is if we said incurred for activities in the state, colon, 1, 2, 3, then that would satisfy what you're after.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Gatto, that's exactly what I'm suggesting, if that is the intention of the committee.
And do we offer any credits right now for, I mean, the same question I asked Mr. Wensler from ConocoPhillips, for any R&D whatsoever? Because it's just still uncomfortable with how would you audit? I mean, I don't know how much research goes into any particular project. It doesn't matter which industry it is. You have enormous expenditures. You could get a credit for these enormous expenditures, which may or may not produce anything. And
I'm not aware of any credits at this time, specifically in R&D.
And do you know, does the federal government have any such things?
May I answer that tomorrow?
Yes.
And I'll certainly find out. In the back of my mind, I think there might be, but I hesitate to answer that, and I will find out and report back.
It seems like the door being opened that it could go pretty wide. Representative Roekberg.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Wilson, I thought we had discussed that in the prior committee, where there was, or in the original draft, you had brought up the fact that there was an U.S. tax code provision that made elections of capital versus deductible expenses in the U.S. tax code.
Through the chair, Representative Roekberg, yes, that we did have that conversation, but in terms of a specific credit for R&D, which is, I understood what the question was, yeah. I'm not right off the top of my head remembering a specific federal credit for that.
Okay, thank you.
And lastly, in that same subparagraph, I would point out that sort of the term of art or the accepted term that I recall is research and development. And I do see here that it says research
or development,
and I'm not clear whether a different meaning is being attached to that or what.
Okay. I think.
And another last comment on that. Online 20, or I'm sorry, 21, a material extension of existing technology. One could read that as being a technology exactly regarding challenged or non-conventional oil, but it's not clear, and I could just see discussions with producers down the road about the meaning of technology. What technology?
Or extension,
or for that matter,
material.
You know, sort of the whole.
Or.
Yes.
Enough lawyers together, we could argue about is.
The irony here, just for the record, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Wilson has suggested some language for this paragraph, and I turned it over to our legal staff, and I got back to it. F is now in this draft, so <yeah. clears throat> there's not 100% pride of authorship here, so I appreciate Ms. Wilson's comments.
I guess I do have another comment on that. The phrase, is a material extension of existing technology, doesn't seem to make grammatical sense in the context. Namely, it says an expenditure is a qualified capital expenditure if it is a material extension of existing technology. So I think just sort of grammatically, perhaps a little closer look at that paragraph would be warranted. On page 5, line 4, that is paragraph G, talks about average gravity. And what I'm not clear about how the average is to be calculated, whether that's a monthly average or daily average or...
Or if there's, is there a standard? I can, that's a question for DNR. Yeah. Perhaps we can ask Mr. Van Dyke.
Mm-hmm. And then also in that section, G little 2, read in conjunction with 1, is confusing. Because little 2 says, except as provided in little 1 of this subparagraph, the API gravity. So it, little 1 says for oil described, and little 2 says the API gravity limit. So I'd like to see it sort of consistent. So if little 2 said for oil described in D, then that would be a little bit more clear.
Mr. Chairman? Little D is the 18 API anywhere, and the little I is all the others. Mm-hmm. So it's our drafting manual, striking back.
Okay, the next item, I'm looking at page 3, line 12. And that language says, a producer may not claim a credit for a qualified capital expenditure more than once. And I'm not sure what that means, because we have said that you can claim a credit for the same expenditure under two different subsections. So I just wasn't sure about that.
Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, that's my fault. I'll own up to this one. I was trying to... from double dipping, but the whole concept of the PPT is the double or triple dip. So that was my intention here, was to try to avoid that, but I think it fails under the application, under the procedures that are put forward for both the credits and expenditures in 488. So if I could, Mr. Chairman, ask Ms. Wilson, would that be... That would be the case, would it not? If any tax credit, if it qualified as a deduction, and then additionally as a credit.
Through the chair, Representative Roper, that is true. One expenditure can qualify for a deduction and a credit. I think if we look back to the PPT language, there was some language in there that precluded taking the same expenditure for two credits, that is under 024 and 025, you had to pick. So it may be, depending on your intention, you may choose to have similar language or not.
Through the chair, Mr. Wilson, I mean, that was what I was driving at, I believe, when I asked that to be inserted, was it to avoid the double crediting, which would be consistent with PPT. Is that correct? Is that what you just said?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, that is correct. Under the PPT, you can pick either 025 credit or 024 for the same expenditure, but you can't get both the 40% and the 20% credit there. So
my heart and mind were in the right place. I just didn't execute it properly. Would that be correct? Would that be consistent then?
Yes, and intention accounts for a lot. The same language I would note is on page 7, line 8.
And we're double dipping and everything right now. So if we were to disqualify this by pointing out an election under 024 or 025, would that correct it, or?
Well, if through the chair, Representative Roper, if it's the committee's intention to, let us say, for a particular expenditure, we know it would get a deduction under the PPT, would get a credit under the PPT, and if the intention then is to add this 15% credit on top, then I believe that what we need to do is simply delete the more than once.
Okay.
Triple dip.
You deduct once, you get a bigger credit. That's the intent. Correct?
Okay.
If you deduct once, you only get to deduct once. And then you get a bigger credit for certain expenditures.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I didn't catch the...
We deduct once, and
correct.
Then you get a larger credit for certain expenditures.
Yes, that would be true.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So if we were expending a qualified capital expenditure for drilling in an Agnew well, would comply with 20 plus 15 equaling 35. Is that, that's how it's supposed to work?
Through the chair, Representative Roakberg, that would be how it would work. I would just point out that if the producer incurred exploration expenses and chose or they had qualified for 0-5, the 40%, then potentially you're adding 15% on top of 40, not 15% on top of 20.
If they're on the 185 credits?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So
way off, right. If you're way out of...
Yeah, right.
So whatever the intention is, you know, we
but
just need
highly unlikely most of the formations under this wouldn't qualify for 185 credits because of their geographic location anyway. Well, the current PAs and all everything else, unless you were an 18 API elsewhere in the state.
Through the chair, Representative Roakberg, just right off the top of my head, and I haven't had a chance to tell you the question, but on page 3 where we define capital, qualified capital expenditure,
mm-hmm.
we say made for an exploration expenditure, and it doesn't say anything about heavy oil. So, and in fact, this says made for exploration expenditure under 4355025. So this bill provides potentially a 15% credit for exploration that qualifies for a 40% credit potentially under 0-5.
That does nothing with heavy oil, just on top of a 40% credit that the producer then chose to go that way because of the distance from Prudhoe and Kuparuk.
Well, 0-5, you're right, has specific distance requirements for the 40%, but this 15% credit does not make that contingent on exploring in heavy oil areas or anything like that, basically.
And it gets back to the same question then, is the access to the information, the seismic, what the explorer expects to find and what they actually do find.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be a question, we probably won't get to Mr. Van Dyke today, but that'll be the questions for tomorrow then.
Yes, and it's
Dyke, as well as for either Mr. Pasvan or Mr. Spencer, if he's still here.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
we should clarify what the policy call is here, because I think that we don't want to we're getting wrapped around an axle about something that won't even happen, I don't think, because of the location of the viscous. It's not going to apply for 0-5 credits, as a matter of fact, I don't think, generally speaking.
To the chair, Representative Roper, I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I'll check on that myself. Okay. I mean, that's be something we can determine pretty readily, and I think even excise that portion if necessary, if that would be the case, because I think it's a non-issue, frankly.
And one last comment: as long as we're looking at that page and that line 16, I'm sorry, 16. It says made for an exploration expenditure under 4355025, and I'm not clear whether that means a credit was taken under 0-5 or whether it qualified as exploration under 0-5. So the under is not clear.
Okay,
flipping over then to page 5, lines 17 through 19. It allows a credit for oil that is non-conventional if certified as such by the department. However, other than tar sands and oil shale, which is specifically enumerated in A and B, the department is given no criteria to judge what non-conventional is. My suggestion would be to describe the criteria to judge non-conventional.
I'm not sure we can do that because it's non-conventional. Ms. Wilson, are you suggesting that the department's not taking discretionary language?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, moving on then. Page 3, lines 2 through 9 is what I'm looking at, and that is subsection D, and that's the part that talks about that the credit may not be transferred except to an affiliate. And I would note that we have current established regulations that define producer as including all members of a group of entities in which one exercises significant influence over others within the meaning of the APB opinion. And so what that means is we've got a regulation that says a producer includes the affiliates, and in D over here in the bill, now we're talking about transferring it to an affiliate, so that immediately calls into question the regulation. For simplicity's sake and consistency with PPT, our suggestion is simply to make the credits fully transferable or not transferable.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Roekberg.
On this point, I appreciate the input from the department here. Is that I would recommend that the committee take the non-transferable option. And the rationale behind that, Mr. Chairman, is that the recognition of the existing known deposits of viscous oil are such that they would be generally only
by the big three,
done by the major producers, which would hold the credits for themselves and wouldn't be transferring them. So in order to make this simpler, that makes it consistent, I think, is that I don't think there's going to be any problem there by making that. That was partially the first intent anyway. It just had to do with an affiliate organization, but if you have a regulation that already fits that, then it allows it by reg anyway. Mm-hmm. So we can delete that and just state that they're non-transferable.
Okay. I would agree with you. I would like to touch base with DNR to see it. What about the Anadarko's? Do they have enough acreage to and enough of a balance sheet?
Well, if they had it, they could still do it, but they just keep it to themselves. I mean, they'd use their own credit. They could still use
the
credit.
The pioneers or the...
Right.
Okay.
Moving on then to page 2, lines 5 through 8. And this language was added, I think, based on my comment the last time, in which I observed that I wasn't clear about the order of the credits to be taken, because one was transferable, one was partially transferable, one was not. And so this was added. I do note that the first part of that paragraph establishes that this credit will be taken last. But then the next part of it says if it qualifies under 025, then that ordering rule doesn't count. So for anything that qualifies under 025, we do not now have an ordering rule. However, if based on my previous comment, the transferability is taken away, then I think we have perhaps less of an issue. But it's something to look at as you draft any changes. Is it may be helpful to add ordering language.
Okay.
Just to clarify, you would say stick with this if we do the non-transferable provision, then you think that would work as a next draft step?
If through the chair, Representative Roekberg, if we stay with non-transferable, mm-hmm. then I think we can delete that. I think we're okay there.
But delete?
Because it would...
Sub 3 here?
Sub 3. But I would like to maybe speak to Mr. Mintz about that question.
So, okay. Well, you brought that up.
How many more do you have to go?
Just about five.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that this is we put that in there for Ms. Wilson's. So for drafting purposes, I'll take it out, and you'll tell us whether we need to put it back in. Okay?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Roakberg, I could get back to you today on the order in question.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, page 2, line 3, says that the credit may be applied against any and all taxes. And that's fine, but note that on line 13, now we've addressed any tax or conservation surcharge. So it just sets up a natural question about, is that different from all taxes due? And our suggestion would just delete any tax or conservation surcharge due and replace with any taxes due, just so the language is consistent between those two parts. And that problem also shows up on page 6, line 2.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure why conservation surcharge was even put in there. Do you recall anything?
Page 2, line 2, which is number 2, and you'd like a period after all taxes due, which also includes then the property and the income tax?
No, what I was suggesting was on line 13, that's where I think the problem is.
I see. Okay, I'm on the...
And so what I'm suggesting is just instead of that saying any tax or conservation surcharge, it just say any taxes due.
And what line are we... Page 3, what?
Page 2, line 13.
Okay, got it. Okay, there. Yeah.
And page 6, line 2.
I got it, right.
Okay.
On page 3, lines 14, and then we're back to this, the guts F, I would just note that the drafting is a little bit consistent about qualifying expenditures and the description of challenged oil, the way the language interlocks. What happens is we've got a focus on exploration, research, or development, but then the description of challenged oil talks about produced. And so I'm not sure that we should be offering a credit for oil that's already been produced. It's okay. Just, again, okay. Sort of what's the intention, and let's make sure the language is, okay. Is real tight. On page 3, lines 16 through 19, I've already noted that although the bill focuses on heavy oil, exploration costs are allowed for any oil.
Okay.
And lastly, page 5, line 24. Let me double check that. Yes, line 24 allows a credit for the development or use. And that looks pretty big to us. And I just want to make sure that that's consistent with the intention.
Pardon me, development or use, correct, on line 24?
Line 24 on page 5 gives a credit for development or use in the state.
Okay.
And that concludes my comments.
And thorough they were. Thank you very much. Are there any further questions? The department right now. What we're going to do is we're going to recess to the call of the chair, and we'll meet tomorrow at 1, and we'll continue this. And if I'll get with Representative Roakberg, and if we can't get enough substance done on the bill, then I'll announce that on the floor tomorrow, and we can cancel and we can pick this up again on Friday at the regular meeting Friday. But we'll plan right now on meeting at 1 o'clock tomorrow. On the same piece of legislation, we can hear. We'll have Mr. Van Dyke. I'll try to make sure that Mr. Van Dyke is on, and also if Mr. Spencer or Mr. Passbanner, if they're at least online for more engineering type questions. I've got questions on kind of how a lot of the engineering things work. So, Representative Seaton, and then Representative Brookberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for being gone and getting back, but I wanted to ask, did it get addressed talking about a sunset at all, or whether this, the intention is that this would be rolled in with the a possible gas contract? Is there, and so we'd be looking at 35 or 40, 30 to 45 years?
There's a sunset.
Okay.
It's a 10-year sunset. Somewhere around here.
I don't see it, so.
Okay, another thing that we can address tomorrow or the next day when we pick the legislation up again. And Ms. Wilson, if you can, do you have some the notes other than the flow chart that you made that
page perhaps, three,
perhaps 15. You could give to the committee members?
Yes,
are they readable and going to be understandable to us, or are they just?
They are. I did email these to you. You're welcome to copy these. I made the notes based on version Y. I have made pencil changes to reflect version I.
Okay, so I is the version that we have in front of us right now, and we will distribute those from that email that you gave me. We will distribute those to the committee members this afternoon. Representative Roper.
And Mr. Chairman, I want to thank Ms. Wilson for the attachment she made to sort that out, because I told the drafter, because we did shift around, but it was an unsettled area, just to have the CS come out about how that would fit together. I appreciate your looking at that way. We perhaps had better organize it this way. And I would say that the EOR language that's in there now, I think we can delete that, because it becomes more or less redundant, because it is heavy oil. Before, the original draft had the EOR provisions apply to all types of oil, not just heavy oil. So I think we can get rid of that, which is one of the suggestions here, because it doesn't make sense here. And then the issue becomes, by using this, is the policy call is whether we're going to use the API gravity test or we're going to use a formation pool narrative descriptive test. That's the question we need to answer there.
As well as the other policy questions, I see it as the R&D.
Right.
Do you want to take a chance on the credit for R&D? When I think it would be difficult to audit what anything could be thrown into that bucket.
Well, then the question then becomes, though, if you do that, we could limit the scope of the applicability of the bill rather substantially and allow that, but then the impact on industry would be substantially reduced if we were just to limit it to R&D activity rather than all heavy oil. That's the one side of it. The other way to go is you allow it for all heavy oil, but then you restrict the amount of R&D, frankly.
We could also talk. Mr. Wensler had a thought earlier on project specific, and I don't know how the industry does it, or how the Department of Revenue, how would you look at auditing a particular project that is, I don't know if it's funded, and it's some questions that we could talk to some of the industry folks to see how it flows in there. Do you normally have a project, some research that's being done for a specific area or for a specific type of oil that then used around the world, and then we're footing the bill for the Liberians?
One comment on that. I guess one of my concerns is it's in the history of the 185 credits, where the department, DNR, has drafted the regulations, and then you make application, but it's my understanding, anecdotally anyway, that as many as 60% of the applications have either been not acted on or denied. So it kind of obviates the intent of what 185 was supposed to do if the bureaucracy is stiff-arming applications. So if we give them almost complete discretion to apply this credit, then we're taking a risk that it will be evenly applied. So that's a concern I have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Is there any other questions for Ms. Wilson before we recess? We will recess to the Representative Seaton.
I just had one question. I'm not sure if Ms. Wilson is the correct person, but if we would look at doing this by specific fields, named fields, do we still have a law of general application, or does that run us afoul of our requirement to have laws of general application. In other words, if we name that we are going to do this for West Sac and two other fields, or what, or Ryan, or whatever, and we name several fields, do we run the constitutional problem of having a, no longer having a law of general applicability and having a law of specific applicability, which we're not doing? So hopefully maybe DNR or revenue will come back.
Although we do it at royalty reduction right now.
Yeah, I think that, I don't think that's a problem, because we'll have a provision if we would go that route to allow either the department or the Conservation Commission to make a determination if a new area would qualify.
Okay.
So that it spreads everywhere if you meet whatever standards they could apply by regulation.
But if you could ask that question, if you're going to be talking to Mr. Minns, that would be great.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to ask him that. I'm not sure of his availability tomorrow. If he can call in, I'm sure he will.
Okay.
Otherwise, I have a list of questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. With that, we will be recessed until 1 o'clock tomorrow.
Thank you.